So there we go. We're now live. So good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology on YouTube. And I'm very honoured to have Richard. I was going to say Richard from Speaker's Corner, but he's not from Speaker's Corner.
Once upon a time.
None of us actually live at Speaker's Corner. People think we actually just live there and this is what we do. But we actually have lives. No, but I've known Richard for a number of years, I guess, from Speaker's Corner. And he is a Christian, but he's not a normal Christian, by which I mean, compared to the other Christians at Speaker's Corner, he is someone who I personally find to be highly intelligent, educated. He has great adab. He is pleasant to talk to. He's not a wind-up merchant, etc., unlike many other Christians at Speaker's Corner who are. So Richard is unusual in that sense. And of course, you could say similar things about Muslims, but we won't go there. Because that's not, we're talking about Muslims. But so I invited Richard to talk about Jesus today, because it's the thing that he finds, you know, he's a Christian, and Jesus is a very important person for Muslims and for the world, particularly the Western world. But Jesus, as he is allegedly predicted or prophesied or spoken about in the Jewish scriptures, what Christians call the Old Testament, what Jews call the Torah or the Tanakh. There are certain texts in the Old Testament which Christians have claimed for themselves as predictions of the Christian Jesus. Jews, of course, have pushed back on that and said, no, they don't, they say something different. And then we've got biblical scholarship, also arguing about the identity of the exegesis of various passages like Isaiah 53, for example, or Daniel, passages in Daniel, etc. And then there's the Muslims who come along and also lay claim to prophecies as well. So it's a real mixture of whatnot. So did you want to, Richard, just say a bit about what you're doing academically at the moment? Because you're doing some very interesting work, I think.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So first of all, pleasure to be on your channel. I have indeed known Paul for many years, and we've always had very pleasant and very fruitful conversations. It's a great honour to be here on Blogging Theology, following on from, is it John Dominic Crossan and Sir Anthony Buzzard and these very well-known names. I'm very honoured to be at a lower level, but still included in the same platform. So thank you very much for having me on. In terms of what I'm doing academically, I was doing academic study at university until recently. I finished that last year. And since then, I've really been doing a lot of my own independent research. During the course of my academic study, lots of difficult questions got thrown up, lots of interesting topics. And so I really took some time to do a lot of reading, try to get my head around those big issues. What I'm doing now, some of you may have spotted my blog site called Steel Man Apologetics. We also post some of the same content at Blogging Theology, and we've had some really good discussions there in the comments sections as well. I've done a few videos. I hope to do more in future, but I'm actually really enjoying just getting my ideas and thoughts down on paper or electronic paper before doing too many videos. That's what I've been up to in a nutshell. As Paul has mentioned, messianic prophecies is a big issue for Christians. It's also interesting for Muslims as well, I think, both because some of the same messianic prophecies in the scriptures are taken to be about Muhammad, Isaiah 42 being one of the classic examples. And as I briefly mentioned to Paul before we actually started recording, I find it interesting that the Quran, of course, talks about Jesus as the Messiah or as Al-Masih. And so the question is, well, what does that actually entail? What supposed messianic prophecies in the Old Testament can Christians and Muslims both happily say, actually, yeah, we're both happy for this to be about Jesus? Perhaps passages which might speak more about his mission to the Jewish people, or perhaps his authority over them, and perhaps less passages about the suffering servant in Isaiah, for example. So what I've done, I've compiled some passages from across the Old Testament, mainly from the prophetic corpus, which I think has something to say about the Messiah. There are different ways of understanding messianic prophecies for those who believe in them. There are direct messianic prophecies where we think that perhaps the human author, or at least the Spirit of God speaking through them, is primarily looking forward into the future to the individual of Jesus of Nazareth. Another approach would be typology, which is to say that a passage originally was about, you know, someone or something else. A classic example, I think it's 2 Samuel 7, which is kind of the institution of the Davidic kingship, which starts with David, which perhaps mentions his son. You know, if his son sins, I will kind of chastise him, which, you know, can't be about Jesus, Christians would say. But that starts the idea of the Davidic lineage or kingship, which finds its ultimate fulfillment in Jesus. Jesus is the ultimate Davidic king. He is the restored Davidic kingship. He is the Davidic king in whom all the hopes of the glories of David's reign come to fruition. So typology and direct prophecies. I was looking through a number of the Old Testament passages, and both of those, by the way, I think are legitimate approaches. And I've just written an article on this topic about whether Muslims can use typology to find Muhammad in the Bible. I think both of these approaches have their place. But as I was looking through these passages and thinking, well, gosh, I think this has something to say about Jesus, but is it direct or is it typological? Broadly speaking, actually, most of them I have found to be direct. And perhaps that's something Paul might push back a little bit on. So anyway, I've got a list, lots of them on there. Paul, what do you think would be most helpful to start with?
Well, just to say, yeah, I agree with what you're saying. I just wanted, before we jump into particular texts, to contextualize the Christian understanding of Jesus a bit more, because Christians, in my experience, and certainly whether it be Roman Catholics or Orthodox or traditional evangelicals, what really matters about Jesus is not that he's the Davidic king, but that he is the Son of God, that he is the second person of the Trinity, that he is God incarnate, in fact, along the lines of John 1.
Yeah.
The theme of the Messianic Jesus is not, you know, right at the top there in terms of, you know, the message. Although it is saying the Gospels, and Gospel of John at the end says, you know, I've written these things that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah. The crucial beliefs about Jesus are the Trinitarian beliefs. Jesus is God himself, become man, second person of the Trinity, that he is reigning now as Lord God of the universe, etc. That's the key belief. And I would say that central Christian belief is not evidenced at all in the Jewish Bible. It's not prophesied at all anywhere, directly or indirectly. So what we're discussing here, we're talking about Messianic prophecies, is a lesser theme in Christian understanding of Jesus. It's not really what matters to Christians. It's that he is the Lord, that he is God, that he is God incarnate. Yeah. So this is not the central issue, I would argue, for Christian faith, that he was the anointed one, that he was a king like David. I mean, it's there, but you're not going to go to the stake over that, I would imagine, so much. This is not the central issue, but the reason I'm saying all this is because if the Christian understanding of Jesus I've just described is so central to salvation, the salvation of humanity, the truth about God, God's action in the world, then that would be found in the Jewish scriptures, predominantly, even more so than the claimed Messianic prophecies. And this larger, more central, more fundamental understanding of Jesus, I would argue, is not found in the Old Testament at all. So in a sense, we're avoiding the larger issue, which is my perceived understanding of the absence of Christian faith about Jesus in the Old Testament at all. On subsidiary matters, I mean, Muslims could agree that Jesus is the Messiah. And if he's prophesied in the Old Testament, fine. No one's going to object to that. That's good.
So I think we agree, if I might just jump back in there. So if I haven't got on yet to the idea of the divine Messiah, do forgive me, I was going to get there. So yes, there's the aspect of kind of the Davidic kingship, and that is certainly the least controversial. That is more of kind of the classical Jewish idea. Jews and Christians, apart from maybe modern liberal Judaism, kind of maybe Orthodox Judaism, the idea of an individual Messiah, quite traditional. It's just disagreement about who that is and how one can recognize that individual. Yes, I think between Christians and Muslims, and perhaps also Christians and Jews, the two key distinctives are, when we are talking about messianic passages, are we also talking about passages where there is a suffering individual who suffers on behalf of the sins of others. And yes, also, as you've touched upon, is this purely a human figure or is it a divine figure as well? You're right, that is one of the crucial issues. There's a lot to talk about there, which is how clearly do we expect that to be expounded or discussed in the Old Testament? Are we open to the idea that greater clarity on the nature of God and particularly the Trinity might be revealed in the New Covenant? I know that James White likes to talk about how the doctrine of the Trinity is revealed, you know, after the last page of Malachi, before the first page of Matthew, kind of in that bit there. There are others, people like, I know Anthony Rogers is very big on this, who tries to trace the Trinity in the Old Testament, and not only in Messianic passages. I am actually quite a fan of that. I think that's an interesting topic, perhaps one that's broader than today. But yes, today, I think it would be helpful to focus on the key things we disagree with, which is the Messiah supposed to die? And is the Messiah purely human or is he beyond that as well? An important point, which it may be helpful to talk about here, is how do we know what is a Messianic passage? I believe, Paul, in one of your videos before, and I've seen this in critical literature as well, there is sometimes the idea that a passage has to say, you know, Mashiach, anointed one, for that to be a Messianic passage. As often in academia, there's great dispute about terminology and what we mean and what is a helpful category or not. What I would say is, first of all, if we do insist upon having the word Mashiach, even though it's very restricted, but actually one of the usages that we do find, which is in Daniel chapter 9, verses 25 and 26, the anointed one there is actually cut off, is actually killed. So one of the few passages that talks about kind of the eschatological Messiah does actually talk about his death. Now, there's a lot more to discuss there and who that's talking about. But in terms of a category, what I mean when I talk about Messiah and what I think many mean is the idea of the eschatological, in a nutshell, the eschatological righteous king. In a nutshell, there are a number of passages, and you find this in Hosea, you find this in Jeremiah, you find this in Ezekiel, where God is speaking, and he says, I will raise up for them, kind of, you know, the shepherd David, I will raise up for them David. And those verses, to my recollection, do not use the term Messiah, but in passages like that, it's talking about an end, kind of towards the end of history, righteous king in the line of David. And classically, that is what we mean when we talk about Messiah. So that's how I understand that term.
Okay, no, that's a fair comment. I think we need to look at this a case by case basis. I think
absolutely.
Yeah, some passages are not talking about the Messiah, even though Christians think they are. Okay. Other passages that may not mention the word Messiah are Messianic. So, but we can't. Yeah. One has to look at each individual case.
Absolutely.
I think you're right. So that fair point. Just a further thing about language of divinity. And this is a very slippery subject. As you will know, I don't need to lecture you, but the word divine, attributing divinity of a human being, does happen in the Jewish scriptures without it being taken perhaps in the hard metaphysical sense, intended to be a literal designation of that individual to be God in the hard sense. Even Jesus actually alludes to this in John chapter 10. Where he refers to the judges as being gods. Kings are called God in Isaiah, Psalm 45, for example, verse 6 and 7. Moses is called Elohim, and so on and so on. And I would argue that some of your passages, which we'll come to, also refer to individuals in the distant Israelite past as God, because you could do that. In the ancient world, the ancient Near East, this language was used with the Egyptian kings, for example, and other people. It did not mean probably what we today mean as you know, modern people mean when we talk about someone being God. We don't literally, I mean, God is usually reserved for the deity, the creator of the heavens and the earth. But even then we do, I mean, to give a silly example, you know, from the Muppets, you know, where Kermit might say to Miss Piggy, you're absolutely divine. You look absolutely divine today. Now, he's not saying...
I love that particular example comes to your mind.
I know. I always will it out because I'm a great fan of Miss Piggy. She's much misunderstood, maligned pig, actually. She's much misunderstood. Anyway, so I don't think Kermit is actually saying that she is God when he calls her divine, because it is just a convention of language in English. It's understood to be a convention rather than a theological statement of truth. And just to give that sort of amusing modern example, in a much broader way, there's a spectrum of understandings of the word God, divine, in the Greco-Roman world, which also is found within Judaism as well. It's not just this, oh, the pagans and the Jews. The Jews also use this kind of language. We see it in Philo of Alexandria, famously, a near contemporary of Jesus, who you heavily Hellenized philosopher, biblical scholar, Jewish guy, of course, you know, referring to Moses as God, you know, in his writings, without any apparent embarrassment. But he doesn't mean that he is literally God. So we need to be careful when divine language is used of anyone in the ancient world. What do they mean? Are they, you know, rather than simply going for, and you're not doing this, but rather than going for the position, they're simply the R, meaning that this person is Yahweh. That's not the case. Often, it you know, there are lots of gods in the ancient world. Either Caesar was called God, son of God, born of a virgin, you know. I would argue also that Paul's language about Jesus is often more like that than, anyway, but that's a different subject.
There's a lot touched upon there. There are some themes for discussion there, which we probably cannot exhaustively or sufficiently cover today. So the relationship between Judaism and its surrounding nations and ideas. Undeniably, there were times when, and we, you know, in the Old Testament, and the Jewish people were influenced by the ideas around them. We also see evidence of resistance to that and rebuking of the ideas of other nations. So, of saying it's in kind of the cultural air is true. The question is how much the Jewish people either consciously, unconsciously, willingly, unwillingly imbibed or rejected it. So there are some interesting passages in the Old Testament. What I would say is, where kind of the boundaries might be blurred, but not in a metaphysical sense, but in a linguistic sense. What I would say is that there aren't actually that, unless I'm mistaken, there aren't actually that many of them. So Psalm 45 is a classic example, where, you know, this king seem, you know, is called Elohim, is described as God. There is Psalm 82 verse 6, which is quoted in John chapter 10, you know, I said ye are gods, but ye shall perish like men. There's Moses being described as Elohim. But what are the contexts?
Isaiah 9 6 is another example of being called.
Absolutely. So I would say maybe there's four or five of these passages which are quite ambiguous. In the whole of the Old Testament corpus, that's actually quite rare. And some of them, it's not actually clear which way you go it. I mean, Psalm 45 has been understood by many Christians as actually a direct messianic prophecy about Christ, saying, because this language so rarely seems to be used in other than a literal sense, other than to God Most High, that must be the case here. And hence, this is a messianic prophecy of Christ.
I think I would take a lead here from John's gospel. Funny for me to say that, but Jesus's point in John chapter 10 is that language of divinity, and this is the gospels now, not just the Old Testament. I mean, your point about the numerical smallness is true, but these are not trivial examples. These are prominent examples in Isaiah, in central, part of the central canon of the Jewish scriptures, the Psalms, and so on. But Jesus himself makes this point in John.
If you don't mind, I was just getting there because you laid out a few, and so if I might respond to those. So you know, Jesus does quote that in John's gospel. What's going on in Psalm 82? There's actually a difference of opinion here in Old Testament scholarship. Perhaps most Old Testament scholarship, you know, might say this is a reflection of the heavenly council, in which case the Elohim there in Psalm 82, that context, might be about kind of these heavenly exalted figures, but who are not quite God. Another interpretation, so someone like Michael Heiser goes for that. Someone like, you know, the very conservative James White would say, you know, no, actually, this is an allusion to the judges of Israel, who I believe, like Moses, are kind of described as Elohim in the Old Testament.
That's my view.
Which brings me on to the last category. But the thing is there, context makes very clear. So with Moses, I forget the exact wording, I'm sure I can look it up, but effectively God says, I will make you as Elohim to Aaron, to Israel. It's explicit there that it's functional, right? You will be like God to these people, or you will be God to these people. And also we have the backstory of Moses, and we know there is absolutely no hint of anything divine about his origins, his nature, etc. So context would determine that. The question is, in some of the messianic passages that we might discuss, is there anything in the context where we can find those parallels and say, this is talking about a judge, this is talking about a Moses-like figure, this is talking about a figure who cannot be divine, who we know for X reason must be human, and it's just exalted language.
Yeah, 9-6. Isaiah 9-6 would be an obvious example for me. So.
Right, Isaiah 9-6, absolutely. Yeah, and that could go either way. I was just reading Williamson on this, H.G.M. Williamson,
in his
ICC.
And a great Old Testament scholar, and he's a Christian as well. But yeah, so what did he say?
He is. So he's talking about the way that this has often been understood, and I suppose similar to Psalm 45? You know, this could be seen as an exalted description within the context of an accession to kingship. It's kind of an accession, you know, hymn or psalm.
Yeah.
And he points out, well, actually, it is interesting that this describes, you know, the birth more so than the accession. Perhaps that's there as well, but there's also birth. So whether it quite fits the paradigm of, oh, this is just exalted hyperbolic language in an accession hymn is quite debatable.
Well, we'll come to that, because we're getting into passages. Just want to say a final thing, but we need to perhaps get to do some work on the passages. Just one final thing, and the reason, and this is to do with the reason why Jews throughout the last 2,000 years have rejected Jesus.
Yeah. Most Jews.
Yeah, 99% of them. This goes to the heart of the theology. For example, how can I put this? In Paul's letter to the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 3, he tells his Corinthian audience what the gospel is. And the gospel is that the Messiah explicitly died for the sins of the world, was buried
according to the scriptures,
according to the scriptures, and then rose on the third day in accordance with the scriptures. Now, this is the gospel according to Paul. I mean, it's not, in my view, the gospel that Jesus preached at all, but this is the gospel that Paul went around, according to Acts. He went around the synagogues in the Greco-Roman world, in Tarsus and Corinth and Galatia, wherever.
Yeah.
And the overwhelming reaction, with some exceptions, was one of rejection by the Jews. He went to the synagogue, presumably on the Sabbath, I guess, and preached as a rabbi would, this message. And the normal reaction is that they kicked him out or even stoned him. Now, why would they do that if he was simply quoting their own Bible, their own Jewish scriptures? And I think the reason is fairly obvious, that what he claims the Jewish scriptures say about a Messiah who was to suffer and die for the sins of the world and rise again is actually absent from those scriptures. So he is not preaching the faith that Moses, and this is the touchstone in Deuteronomy, it says, if anyone brings any message other than the one that Moses has brought, then, you know, he is to be rejected as a false prophet. So there is this kind of built-in reaction against any novelties or unprecedented views that are not found in the Torah. And I think that's why the Jews overwhelmingly rejected Paul's gospel. It's because there was no evidence for it in their own scriptures that they knew very well. Because if it was there and it was obvious, they wouldn't have rejected him. They would have said, oh, yeah, we know about that, Paul. We've been waiting for this for the last 500 years. Hallelujah, it's finally come true. They didn't say that. They rejected his message. So I think the rejection of the Christian Jesus is different from the rejection of the historical Jesus, who I don't think articulated those beliefs. Now, this is a whole other issue to do with the Gospels and what they, how we understand them and how they're to be reconstructed historically. But my point is this, that when I read the Old Testament myself, or the Jewish scriptures, I don't find anywhere the idea that the Messiah was to die for the sins of the world and then be raised again on the third day. I just don't see it anywhere. And that is the Christian definition, I would argue, of the Messiah. That's his job description. That's his vocation. That's why he came to earth. He came down to earth to die for the sins of the world. Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world, has John. So you and I can agree there may well be messianic passages in the Torah, and I have no problem with that. I expect to see them. But the distinctly Christian understanding of the Messiah, as evidenced by 1 Corinthians 15, I think is absent from the Jewish scriptures completely. It's not that there are hints. I just don't think it's there at all. And that's why Muslims and Jews have always rejected the Christianized Messiah, but they accept the Jewish Messiah, because there was no sense before the rise of Christianity of this Pauline belief in a dying and rising savior who was the Messiah. That was simply missing from the Jewish scriptures until Christianity came along and said it was there. But Jews remain unpersuaded. I think biblical scholarship, I mean, I've got tomes here from mainstream Christian scholars, also don't see it. They talk about census plenor, which is a kind of typology thing. A census plenor is the more Catholic jargon in the Catholic Church. I mean, it's Latin phrase, as you know, of course, meaning the fuller meaning. Now, that's okay. I don't have a problem with that. But as long as we root it in the historical understanding, the exegesis, a good objective understanding of the text, I don't have a problem if you say, well, Isaiah 53 means X. But in our worldview as Christians, it can also mean Y in a fuller sense. Now, I don't have a problem with that because at least you're honestly looking at the two stages. But if one simply jumps into Isaiah 53 and there's other passages and says, no, these mean what the Christians later came to say it meant, then it's going to fail because it doesn't say that. You have to have some kind of, as what you call typology, what Catholics are, I prefer the Catholic term census plenor because it's slightly more nuanced, I think, than the sense of just types. And more evocative of multiple ways of interpreting it. So that's kind of my broad canvas on this. Messiah, yes, in the Bible. Christian understanding of Messiah, no. Other understandings of Messiah, the Islamic understanding and the Jewish understanding, which are basically very similar, we can come onto that, yes. So that's my stall I've just set out.
well, let me come and browse your wares. That's your
stall. you can talk a metaphor to the cows come home.
Absolutely.
So shall we select a juicy passage?
I'd love to get on to the passages. I feel there was quite a lot there that I'd like to respond to, if that's okay.
Of course.
Thank you. Lots of very interesting thoughts there, and I can understand where you're coming from for much of it. So a few things. So first of all, in terms of most Jews rejecting this.
Yeah.
So from the Christian perspective, we actually think this is part of the prophecy. So in something like, Isaiah 49, there are hints there that perhaps this mission hasn't gone down very well. I think that may have been verse 3 or verse 4. I'd have to double check. In Isaiah 52 to 53, which is the suffering servant passage, there's the and who the we is speaking. Is that Israel or the nations? I think it's Israel. They talk about, who has understood what has happened. We thought he was despised and rejected, but actually, his suffering was atoning for our sins. Yeah. So the idea, and in Zechariah as well, with the pierced one in Zechariah chapter 12 and verse 10, it talks about those who have pierced someone, whoever that might be, and then they will repent over this. They will mourn for him as they mourn for an only son. And shortly thereafter, in chapter 13, verse 1, seemingly upon this repentance, a fountain of cleansing of sin is opened up. So we would actually say that the Old Testament itself talks about the suffering Messiah, who is not recognized by the Jewish people. In fact, in Zechariah chapters 12 to 13, that can quite easily be read as eschatological in the fullest sense, the very end of history. It is at that time that the Jewish people will recognize the one they have pierced, and they will recognize that and put their faith in him, and a fountain of cleansing will open up. So we do actually think that's scriptural. Now, in terms of your point about the Jews rejecting Jesus as well, I would say there's a secular way of understanding that, but there's also an Islamic way, which is, how does the Quran speak about the Jewish people? The Jewish people as a historical entity, it talks about them as having, killed the prophets or attempted to kill the prophets. They are basically told off for rejecting Jesus and uttering calumnies against him. So the fact that, the Jews didn't understand Jesus in the way that the early Christians were portraying him is actually very much in line with what the Quran itself teaches. You mentioned also about Christian scholars and how they've understood some of these passages. And you're right, some of these Christians would understand these passages in a way that I would not. It might be worth highlighting to our audience, and I'm sure you know this as well as I do, that Christian is a very, very broad camp. Within that, you will have people who are broadly evangelical, like myself, who have a very high view of scripture, inerrancy, infallibility, however you wish to define that. But then you have other Christians who basically do not have that presupposition, who are open to the idea that scripture has errors in it, who might think that God, by his very nature, does not foretell the future. I'd have to find it in my notes in one of the passages. It says, Christians understand this to be talking about a future individual, but that view is incorrect because the scriptures do not teach this. But of course, in saying that, they are rejecting one of the key very passages that Christians go to. So presuppositions are absolutely crucial as we are discussing these texts. Thank you. I think that's what I had to say.
Fair point. Okay, so shall we, can we just put on one side Isaiah 53, because this is the main text. Otherwise, the danger is if we jump into Isaiah 53 immediately, we're never going to get to anything else. Because this is such a complex and convoluted and contested passage, I think if we could perhaps go to lower hanging fruit.
Should I perhaps summarize what I think are some of the key verses? Would that be helpful?
Oh, yeah. And then pick one. What I'm trying to say is actually pick a verse other than Isaiah 53, just to get us in the doing something, some work on these passages, and then leave the big one till later, if that's all right. Okay. Otherwise, we're just going to be absorbed with that one and we're never going to see the light of day or anything else, I think. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just, do I have a Bible to hand as well? Excellent. I won't summarize all the passages. I'll just pick one.
Because I think the devil's in the detail here, rather than kind of broad strokes. We need to actually look at the individual passages and see, because the issues, you quoted some things about being pierced and so on. The issues here about translation of these words, there's the other translations of those terms as well. So we have to look at each case by case, I think. So, if I could, you're welcome to pick a passage. That's right.
Yeah. Well, I think we have to look at them case by case, but also in the whole. And this again comes back to presuppositions. Whatever our interpretation might be, it has to make sense of the details of the text. So, classic example: Christians love talking about Isaiah 53, but sometimes we're not so good at explaining. Well, what does it mean saying he shall see Zerah, seed or offspring? How does that particular bit fit Jesus, who did not have biological children? So the details are very important, but I would also say when we are interpreting a passage, both we should understand Jewish Old Testament texts in light of others, because that's a relevant cultural milieu. So, many scholars have noticed, it's debatable, but many scholars, even critical scholars, have said Zechariah 12:10, there might be hints here of Isaiah 53. Can we understand one passage in light of another? That there is also a methodological thing here, which is, if we approach the Old Testament as believers in God and in scripture, we will attempt to interpret similar texts together and particularly in harmony with each other. So yes, let's get into the details, but I would also say that certain passages can shed light on other passages.
I think you're right. There's the individual text, and there's the canonical level, and there's a theological level, there's the confessional level, Christian, Muslim, Jew. I think it's the sense, I don't normally praise postmodernism, but because we live in a postmodern world, we can have this multi-layered approach to a text. So, and recognize the compartmentalized the different truths at different levels. There's something Dale Martin has written about in his marvelous recent book on the Bible, the postmodern understanding, and he's a Christian. But my point is this, that I'm going to, my initial entree into any given text that we might discuss is going to be at the historical critical level, at the level of academic scholarship as understood in Western universities. You've studied this, obviously. Yep. This is not, and I stress, this is not to deny any other meaning. There are other meanings that can be understood of these passages. The Christian understanding is one of them. Also, the Jewish understanding is another. Also, the Muslim understanding is another. Those are also part of the picture. So I'm not, and also there's the one text, there's a canonical text that you alluded to. So, how does this text fit in with the wider canon? That also influences its meaning. You're absolutely right to say that. Theological meaning, rah, rah, rah. So there are multiple.
Well, let's do the historical critical.
That's what I want. first, because I find that more useful to ground it in that. I'm not ruling out any other interpretation on principle. That my position not that only the historical is true, far from it. I believe in theological meanings or even allegorical meanings or fuller census fuller. I don't have a problem with census fuller either. Yeah. If it's tamed and not wild.
But my point, sorry, wasn't just about the canonical. It was even historical, which is if we have, let's not assume the Old Testament is the word of God or any such thing. But if we have an 8th century Jewish text that says something about, so, I mean, you know, Isaiah, depending on when you date different bits of it, you know, let's say some of it's from the 8th century, some of it's from the 6th century. This that Jewish text may well, it is part of the historical milieu of another 6th century text, which is Zechariah.
Exactly.
Even think treating it purely as a human document.
Yeah.
You know, it is historically very relevant to look at other Jewish texts.
Yeah. Well, this is why this subject is so fascinating and also so complicated, because there are these levels of interpretation. And that's part of the pleasure of it for me. It's not simply, you know, it's why I can never be an accountant. That's a random thing to say. You know, this is much richer and much more fascinating than binary kind of mathematical counting, so to speak. Okay, well, given what you've said, it's helpful, and my own presupposition is that there are multiple levels of possible meaning, but we can at least begin with the historical critical issues of context, exegesis, authorship, etc. Okay, we're agreed on the starting point, so go ahead, choose your text, and the elephant until later.
Bear with me, I'm just moving up my Bible software onto a different screen. Let's do that. So, let's go for, if we're going to bracket Isaiah 53, and I can completely see why we might want to do that.
Just for practical reasons.
Absolutely. Let's have a look at Daniel 9. Daniel 9, and then around verses 25 and 26. And let me just preempt our discussion. So, you know, I'm a Christian. I'm interested in these passages. I've you know, tried to read commentaries on a number of these passages, sometimes critical, sometimes, you know, evangelical. I'm an evangelical. I'm sure, Paul, you will ask questions about the text to which I do not know the answer, but I will, you know, attempt as best as I am able.
You're not expecting you to give all the answers to everything. That would be amazing. It'd be amazing if you could. That would be a...
Indeed. Unfortunately, some people's brains work like that, but not mine. So the reason I picked Daniel chapter 9 then, I mentioned before kind of in the prologue, this is actually one of the places in the Old Testament where we do get the Hebrew term Mashiach, which is anointed. That can be used in the Old Testament in a number of different contexts. That might be a king or a priest. Yes. Here it talks about an anointed one, a prince. I think that might be Nagid in the Hebrew. So let me read, I'll read the NRSV, because that's a scholarly translation, and Paul, I know that you're a fan of that.
But not exclusively, there are other translations I use. I will be referring, by the way, just to declare my hand, the Jewish Study Bible. This is published by Oxford University Press. It is a one-volume compendium of critical scholarship from the Jewish perspective. So some of the world's top Jewish academic scholars on the Torah have written this, compiled this. So on this particular issue, I will be referring to the Jewish commentary and translation of this. The NRSV, although it is excellent, is nevertheless a Christian translation, and that is evident in the differences one sees between that and the Jewish translation. And these differences need to be mentioned, because it's not a case, as you know, of, you know, all translations interpretation, and therefore it's coming from somewhere. It's not 100% neutral.
The Jewish Study Bible is an excellent resource. I fully agree. So let me read it in the NRSV for the sake of simplicity. Cool. So I'll pick up in verse 24 and I'll read to the end of verse 26. And Daniel, for context, it is portrayed as being by Daniel around the time of the Babylonian exile, which would be 6th century BCE. Critical scholarship, very commonly, if not universally, would date it actually to, I forget, second, third, I think second century
I'm BCE. I'm going to come to that in a second.
Okay. But let's read this passage. So starting verse 24, 70 weeks are decreed for your people. And your holy, so this is an angel, a messenger, Gabriel, in fact, talking to Daniel. Yeah. 70 weeks are decreed for your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to put an end to sin and to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal both vision and prophet, and to anoint either a most holy place or a most holy thing or one. Know therefore and understand, from the time that the word went out to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the time of an anointed prince, which I believe is Mashiach Nagid, there shall be 7 weeks, and for 62 weeks it shall be built again with streets and moat, but in a troubled time. After the 62 weeks, an anointed one, Mashiach, shall be cut off and shall have nothing, and the troops of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Its end shall come with a flood. And to the end, there shall be war. Desolations are decreed. So that's the end of verse 26. Now, what would a Christian understanding of this passage be? There are differences in some of the details, even though some of the key elements of this passage are much more commonly understood. That's true with you know, some other messianic prophecies as well. So the angel comes to Daniel and talks about 70 weeks. This is generally, I think, not taken literally as 70 weeks, but as 70 weeks of years. There are different ways of computing that. One would be kind of 490 years or so, or whatever the maths would be on that. And then it talks about within this time period, certain things being done to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for iniquity. Some Christians would say, you know, the doing away of sin, atoning for iniquity, that will happen by Jesus within this time period. Some will see elements as to bring in everlasting righteousness, to anoint a most holy one. Some would say that was kind of provisional. That's what the Jews were supposed to do. They were supposed to repent, become righteous, recognize Jesus. Others would say, no, this righteousness comes through Jesus. So slightly different ways of understanding that. But effectively, within this 70 weeks, momentous things, including the dealing with of sin, will be accomplished. Now, the key reason I bring this up is it talks about an anointed prince in verse 25, and then in 26, an anointed one shall be cut off. Now, conservative commentators understand cut off here as a reference to death. I'd be interested, Paul, to know the Jewish Study Bible in front of you, if that's talking about death as well, or if there is some debate about what cut off means here. I thought that was the kind of the critical view as well, but I could be mistaken. In terms of who this individual will be, so hold on, I think I've prepared some information on this.
The good question is, we're going to begin this discussion on historical critical level rather than a Christianized, the historical critical level cannot include, I would respectfully suggest, the Christian interpretation of these passages, because Christianity did not exist before Christ.
That's fine. Sorry, I was just trying to explain why I've chosen it of interest, but sorry, yes, fine. Let's bracket all that. So
because there's nothing Christian about this passage read historically critically. You can, on the other level that we mentioned, bring a Christian interpretation in. But we agree to enter into this on an historical critical level. And that's what I'm doing, rather than jumping to a Muslim, a Christian, or any other understanding that...
Fine, habit of reflex. So there is an anointed one who is cut off. So some of the important questions here would be... who is anointed and what does it mean to be cut off? My understanding of cut off is that this is a reference to death. Perhaps I'm mistaken on that. Paul, if you know...
I was going to say, not the death of the Messiah. I'm not going to say anything yet. You present your case, but I'm not going to jump in and start, unless you want me to respond now, but you carry on.
Well, I mean, Paul, so there's some kind of anointed figure in verse 26 that is cut off. What's your understanding of cut off?
Okay, so, well, I'm not going to just... deal with that issue. I need to just step back and deal with why we're even looking at this passage. Now, as you rightly say, virtually all, if not all, historians, critical scholars, do not think that the prophet Daniel, as an historical individual, authored this text. And I'm just going to quote from a guy I know you're a big fan of, Bar Ehrman. That was a tongue-in-cheek. He's written this book, The Bible, A Historical and Literary Introduction. It's published by Oxford University Press. Lots of praise from other academics on the back for it. And what is, I just wanted to, on this, on Daniel, I just wanted to share what he said, which is pretty mainstream. He says that Daniel is a fictional character. These stories are post-exilic. They are probably debated to the 4th or 3rd century BCE. I've heard they usually dated to the 3rd century BCE. Why does this matter? It matters because if responsible mainstream historians do not think that Daniel had anything, the historical Daniel had anything whatsoever to do with his book, if it is fictional, if it is authored in the 3rd century, and it's interesting, it's not even one of the prophets in the Jewish scriptures, because it is the last book to be written in the Jewish corpus, which is why it's at the very, very end. It's not even put together with the prophets because it's so late. I know this is not a historical critical question, but it's to do with, you know, I'm not taking this as history. I'm not taking this as Daniel, the historical Daniel. No one does outside of fundamentalist circles. This is not by Daniel, the historical Daniel. It's by an unknown writer in the 3rd century BC. Very, very late, just about got into the Jewish canon. It's fiction, all right? So I'm not going to take any momentous prophetic lessons from this if we're moving on to the other levels of interpretation. But anyway, leaving that issue, that rather important point aside, it's like if we're using a hadith, which we know is not authentic. You know, we don't make, you know, rulings from that. We don't take, this is not, it's not a historical figure. He says here, Daniel, talking about the book, is not a historical figure who makes real-time proclamations to the people of Israel in the light of their dire situation and almost certain coming destruction. That is the mainstream view. This is not history. So once we understand it's a made-up story, it's fiction, it's not by Daniel, it's written in the 3rd century, just about got into the Jewish canon, then that's my context. So I personally, for faith, don't take this as in any way normative or in any way substantive for faith, because it's not by Daniel. Like lots of texts that claim to be by famous people are. So now coming to the text itself, I'll read it from the passage you just read from here, because there are differences in meaning. Some of your points don't actually translate into this translation. Okay. And I mentioned some of the historical reference. So this is now an historical critical reading of this text. Verse 24 onwards reads, 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city until the measure of transgression is filled and that of sin complete, until iniquity is expiated and eternal righteousness ushered in and prophetic vision ratified and the Holy of Holies anointed. Interesting. You must know and understand, from the issuance of the word to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the time of the anointed leader is 7 weeks. And for 62 weeks, it will be rebuilt square and moat, but in a time of distress. And then it goes on more kind of, oh, and after those 62 weeks, the anointed one will appear and vanish. The army of a leader who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary, but his end will come through a flood. Desolation is decreed until the end of war. So an attentive watcher of this will notice already some significant differences between what you read from the NRSV, a translation I have huge respect for, and this Jewish scholarly translation. Now, they provide some helpful notes as to the passage, and I'll just read them, verses 25 and 26. Anointed leader, anointed one. This is in italics. The word anointed in verse 25 and 26 is the Hebrew Mashiach, as you have said, Andrew. Thus, these verses have given rise to much Christian speculation. In the context of the other historical references, however, the anointed leader probably refers to either Zerubbabel or the high priest Joshua. See Ezra 3:2 and Zechariah. I mean, here's a whole bunch of biblical references. While the anointed one is most likely to be the high priest Onias the third, killed in 171 BCE. See 2 Maccabees 4:30. In the Bible, Messiah, this is Messiah, never refers to the future ideal Davidic king. This use is post-biblical. The prince is Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, as we know from the Gospels. Anyway, that's different. Verse 27, half a week, the 3.5 years of the Maccabean revolt that had transpired at that time, or that had transpired to that time. Translator's note on 725, appalling abomination, probably new altar stones placed on the altar in the temple upon non-Jewish sacrifices were offered to foreign deities. One Maccabees and there's various quotes. I mean, this is an historical critical reading, unlike the Christian reading, which is an interpretation based on Christian presuppositions. So some significant voice issues here is, you understood that?
I'd love to comment on that. Okay.
So there is no reference here to a Christian Messiah figure dying. That's not the reference. The reference is to someone, either the high priest Zerubbabel or the high priest Joshua, or he talks about the high priest Ananias the Third, killed in 171 BCE. Of course, you can say that if you believe that Daniel is in fact not by Daniel, but an earlier, a much later text. You can then cross-reference it historically with other contemporary events in the real author's lifetime. So there we go. That's a very different reading, which doesn't require Christian interpretation. It doesn't require Christian interpretation, that's right. Sorry.
Okay, very good. So one of the key things we're discussing is whether the Messiah will be killed. So what this passage does talk about is some kind of Mashiach, that is, and my translation had cut off. I think the translation in the Jewish Study Bible, I think you mentioned, went away, he shall appear and then go away.
It doesn't have cut off, it said disappear and vanish.
Disappear and vanish, thank you. The Hebrew word here, let me just track it down again, yikareth. I don't know why I'm rolling my R's. I don't know if the Hebrews did that. Karath is to cut. So you cut a covenant, Karath. So cut off is actually, I would say, a much more literal translation than what you find in the Jewish Study Bible.
On the translation of the Hebrew here, okay. There's a comment here on the Hebrew, on this very passage. It says, the meaning of the Hebrew is uncertain.
Oh, textually. No, meaning.
Not the text necessarily, the meaning of the Hebrew is uncertain. Now, I'm not a Hebrew scholar. These are Hebrew scholars. They say the meaning is uncertain. I'm not quite clear then where they get the idea, how they come up with the translation. Possibly they're drawing on Septuagint issues. You know, I'm sure there's a whole bunch of things they're drawing on.
Yeah.
But the cut off or vanish, it's not clear from the original text what is meant. It is uncertain, according to the experts.
Okay. The NRSV also indicates when things are unclear. We actually have that on the previous page of Daniel. Here, they don't indicate any uncertainty. All I can say is, with my experience of Hebrew, karath is a very common verb. It very literally means to cut, including to cut a covenant. That's a common expression. So perhaps it can have other meanings. Maybe there's more uncertainty than I'm aware of. All I would say is that the root meaning, the etymological meaning, which is not always determinative, I would say fits the context very well. I would also say interpretation. Most critical commentators and Jewish interpretation do understand this to be about figures who were killed. As you mentioned, and John Collins also in his critical commentary mentions, Ananias in the second century is perhaps the most popular interpretation here.
Yeah.
And he was killed, unless I'm mistaken. That fits here.
Yeah.
Exactly. We go back to the issue about language, which is, well, what do we mean by Messiah? So for the statement, you know, the Messiah shall or shall not be killed. If we mean by that just is the word Messiah ever used with being killed, I would say that seems to be what's going on here. If we mean Messiah in terms of eschatological Messiah, then we have a question about, well, does the author of Daniel, this section of Daniel, whoever that is, do they understand this to be some kind of messianic figure? And that then would be open to debate. You know, if it is Ananias the Third, as most scholars think, did he think that he was he was living in the end of time? I think, you could interpret Daniel in that way. What I would say is, as a Christian, I think Jesus is still a good reading of the text. Now, and I argue that,
it doesn't bear mention with me. Jesus in the text. It doesn't
mention. Well, it doesn't mention his name in the same way that, you know, Muhammad is not mentioned by name in Isaiah 42,
it's not about Muhammad, this. It's not about Islam, this discussion. You see, Messiah is a title, it's not a name, that means anointed one. There are lots of people it could refer to. It is historically arbitrary, although highly motivated in your case, to suggest someone in the distant future might be this person. When, according to the Jewish Study Bible, the historical reference, they say, for anointed leader, they're much more likely candidate, historically plausible at hand. For example, they say probably refers to Zerubbabel or the high priest Joshua. And it gives four references we can look up. Ezra 3:2, Haggai chapter 1, Zechariah 6:9-15. These are the plausible candidates for this individual.
Perhaps I should explain where I'm coming from.
To jump arbitrarily centuries later.
But you're assuming I'm being arbitrary. I think you've made your point, if I might make my point in response to this, because I think you're repeating an earlier point. So what do we mean by historical critical, right? In the sense that I've agreed, let's try and look at this passage historically critically. What I mean is, let's try and understand it in its historical context, in a grammatically plausible way. You know, let's try and do responsible exegesis. What I did not mean when I said let's look at it in that way is, let us only go with the mainstream conclusion that historical critical scholarship comes to, because.
But there's no reference to Jesus.
I would say there is an anti-supernatural bias in that.
Well, what's supernaturalism got to do with anything? I don't get what.
Okay. So as I was preparing for this, you know, I read some of these critical scholars who would say, you know, Christians say this, the passage means this, but, you know, Old Testament prophecy, you know, does not talk about the future, or, you know, well, it can't because other passages don't, even though this one doesn't. Presuppositions seem to be quite important in terms of, is it plausible that this person might be talking about the future?
I don't see that there's anything to do with the supernatural, with demons and magic and miracles. This is to do, they say, in the context of other historical references. However, anointed leader probably refers to Zerubbabel or high priest. Historical critical studies, you know, then bringing jumping to a far distant future figure called Jesus of Nazareth has nothing to do with this fictional account written in the 3rd century BC.
How do you know that conclusion?
Because it doesn't. There's no evidence for that. It's simply
you've not let me present my evidence yet.
No, but an historical critical reading, it is historically arbitrary to have your preferred figure referenced in a text written many centuries before, a fictional text which is concerned with the issues at its own historical level of interaction. This is not prophecy, by the way. This is a fictional, it's like a novel. It's a made up story. There's no, if I just finish here, Richard, you're making a category mistake here.
Okay.
You're making a category mistake, an intellectual category mistake. What we're looking at in Daniel, I would suggest, is a work of fiction.
Okay. We're not. You've mentioned that. Can I respond to that? Because you've made that out before.
Let me just finish what I'm saying. Because you're assuming it's historically by Daniel, that seems to be the presupposition you're working with here, who's actually making supernatural prophecies about the future. I would argue that this is not an historical critical reading, not because I'm anti-supernatural, but because of genre. It's a basic feature of historical inquiry to understand the nature of the text we're dealing with. Your presupposition is that it's a supernatural prophetic text about the future. I'm saying no, it's a work of fiction written centuries after the real Daniel, and it's you're misinterpreting the whole genre. It's not prophecy. It's a made-up story about a bunch of, you know, you're not getting the genre issue right first. You're treating it like real prophecy. It's not real prophecy. It's a made-up story.
Okay. Well, I think we're disagreeing. So a number of points in response to that. So I think we are disagreeing about, yes, that the nature of Daniel. So You're right. Most critical scholarship would say that Daniel is not written by the Daniel portrayed as living in the 6th century BCE.
You think it is? You think Daniel wrote this? So what is your...
Well, let me finish what I'm talking about.
Carry on.
Thank you. So yes, most critical scholarship would say, you know, that's not what's going on here. He's not actually prophesying the future. Really? In the language, the genre of, you know, apocalyptic or whatever it might be, and prophecy, it's portrayed as portraying the future, yeah. But the historical author is not actually doing that.
Yeah.
Now, this is a debated phenomenon. You're right, most scholarship is with you on this. There are still conservative scholars, evangelical scholars, who would say, actually, no, we can defend the case that the historical Daniel did write this, who would say that the liberal interpretation actually doesn't fit that well. So, you know, if you take the 70 weeks from the start date, now the start date, I should mention, is disputed. There are at least a few plausible candidates, but whichever one of them you go for, it doesn't really seem to actually, you know, even if this is made up after the fact, the author actually did quite a bad job of that. And it doesn't actually fit the timeline up until Antiochus Epiphanes and Annius III. It doesn't actually fit that very well.
But Andrew, and what is your view? What is your, you're going to give me, I know about these other scholars. I'm aware of them, because, but my question was, Richard, what is your view? Are you defending that the actual historical Daniel, centuries before, actually wrote this? Is this your view? Because I want to know, is your presupposition here, if you're coming from it from a religious perspective, because you're an inerrantist, which you've already admitted you are, then you are committing...
Inerrancy
means, by my understanding of the Chicago Declaration, which I'm sure you're aware of, that if a book says it's by Daniel, it's by Daniel, the historical Daniel. There's no wiggle room on that. So you are committed by a religious presupposition, not based on the scriptures itself, that a text must be X or Y, not based on historical reading, but on a religious dogma, a presupposition you have. So I want to know where you're coming from. Are you coming from a dogmatic religious position when you read Daniel, or are you coming at it from an historian's point of view?
If I put aside, or do my best to put aside, my dogma, I do not know between the options. I can see where kind of, you know, mainstream scholarship is coming from, but I can also see some flaws in their approach, which is, you know, the 70 weeks, does that actually fit very well? That's not necessarily the best candidate for it. The description that is made about him coming, you know, destroying the city and the sanctuary. Well, Antiochus Epiphanes, you know, yes, he set up an abomination of desolation, but did he actually go as far as, you know, destroying it? And so from a non-committed faith perspective, I say, well, the liberal perspective, I mean, really a huge amount of this comes down to actually Daniel chapter 11 and the description of the king of the north and the king of the south. And there's a certain point, and if I remember my directions correctly, it's the king of the north who was Antiochus Epiphanes. And there's a certain section where most scholarship thinks the prophecy starts going wrong. And that's the point at which the author is actually trying to predict the future and, you know, fails spectacularly. And I can see that approach, but, you know, that could also be read in a different way, such that
do you know of any scholars, I mean, actual specialists in the Old Testament, who are not motivated by conservative evangelical dogma, who believe that Daniel is written by the prophet Daniel?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Can you name a single one?
Not off the top of my head, no.
But it's an important point, because if you take away the religiously motivated agenda here to certain conclusions, you don't find people agreeing that is by Daniel. You find 99.9% of the scholars in any mainstream scholarly publication, where we can look at the Oxford commentaries, we could go to Bar Irma, we could go to the New Jerusalem commentary, the Premier Roman Catholic publication, we can go to the Orthodox Jew. They're all agreed, all of them, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
They're all agreed that Daniel is a fiction, a work of fiction. And for Christians to base serious prophetic messianic prophecy on fiction is not a great argument. That's my point. You're not going to persuade anyone who doesn't share your religious presuppositions in the first place, who doesn't already share Christian views about the thing in the first place. You're not going to persuade anyone, because it's simply not there. So it's a circular argument. You believe it because you believe it, because it's true because you believe it. It's a circular argument.
Yeah. I mean, as you know, I've spent a fair time in the secular academic world, and I am very aware that, well, from my experience has been, you know, from reading a number of scholars, sometimes their own explicit statements, is that a number of factors are very important. If I say this, I'll be ridiculed by most people. If I, you know, this cannot be true because this is not a divine work. X, Y, you know, presuppositions are important. And very. Certain ideas gain, you know, you will often find a scholar saying this idea has become overwhelmingly popular, even though the actual original arguments in favor of it have actually weakened over time. There are such things as kind of academic orthodoxies and shibboleths, and occasionally someone comes along and shatters them. Yeah. So let me break it down. You know, as a Christian, I think this is about Jesus. If I am purely secular, if I discount the possibility that this might be talking about the future, and I wonder how many scholars that would apply to, then yeah, it's not about Jesus, because it can't be about Jesus. If I come to it trying to understand it in its historical context and being open to maybe it's a prophecy, maybe it's not, let's see what the author is saying, then I think it's debatable. You know, maybe he is talking about Jesus, maybe it's not. Maybe it's Ananias and the 70 weeks isn't supposed to be taken literally, even though that actually fits Jesus much more nicely. It's just kind of a round number. What I'm trying to say is, from a non-committal perspective, both of those options are on the table. And actually, that's something I should clarify. It can be fruitful to have a non-committal approach where you say, maybe this isn't the word of God, maybe this is the word of God. Let's just try and see which way the text points us to, what the text is compatible with. But yes, I do not adopt a secular, this cannot be a prophecy, because I just don't think that's relevant for Christians and Muslims to discuss.
I think citing scholars whose presupposition, whose whole dogmatic orientation is to believe in inerrancy, certainly wholly determines their exegesis. If you start from the premise, which you do, very conservative evangelical and fundamentalist scholars start from the premise of the inerrancy, then, in other words, whatever the Bible...
That's not what I'm doing here.
I think you are and you're not. I think there's because no historical, in my view, no historical reading of that text would ever come up with Jesus. It's just simply not there. Now, the very fact that you even countenance that is because of your presuppositions, which are not historical. They're based on belief as a faith, as a Christian.
But there, I feel like you want me to adopt a secular, this cannot be a prophecy, rather than what I would say is more fair, which is a non-committal approach. No, maybe it's not.
I'm adopting a historical thing. If this was by Daniel, if there were good reasons like Daniel, and I'm completely accepting a prophecy, and there were some amazing prophecies in there, and there was an extraordinary correspondence between those prophecies and future events, I would say hallelujah and accept it.
Yeah.
It would be very easy, pushing an open door on that, absolutely no resistance to that whatsoever. But this is something you're shoehorning it in when it's not there, and then complaining about anti-supernaturalist scholarship. But actually, that's not the issue. The issue is of this dogmatic presupposition that's talking about someone who, on any objective, be it Catholic, Jewish, or secular reading, has nothing to do with Jesus. You're shoehorning it in, and that is a presupposition working. It's not historical analysis.
I feel like there's something going on where I'm saying, look, if I, you know, do my best to bracket my beliefs and approach this text and say, maybe it's prophecy, maybe it's not, let's try and understand this as a historical document, I think a good case can be made for Jesus. I feel like you're then saying, you're self-deluded at best, if not just, you know,
motivated by faith to say these things.
So okay, well in that case we're not going to get anywhere, because I say to you, you know, sincerely, if I do my best to bracket my faith, I still think a good case can be made that this is about Jesus, and you're effectively saying you can't think that.
No, you're saying that because you're a Christian, not because of
but
being a Christian is not a good reason for reading a text in a certain way. That's just a religious
interpretation. No, because you're assuming that I'm reading it as a Christian, whereas I am telling you, if I try and take off my Christian glasses,
I'm unpersuaded you've done that successfully. I think your glasses are still there, even though you think you've taken them off.
That's fine. But I'm saying I want to talk about what the arguments in favour would be. And your response seems to be, You're only saying that because of your Christian presuppositions.
Yeah, I think that's true. You see, it's like, I mean, I don't want to get into Islam on this, but, you know, okay. Muslims do what you're doing, and, you know, and therefore I'm in sense conceding the validity of what you're doing to some extent. You know, they see Muhammad in Isaiah 42. Now, I would say on an historical critical reading that...
For which, by the way, our viewers should go to the excellent article recently shared on Blogging Theology.
Oh, indeed they should. You should always read your articles. They're always very well written. And I would make the same complaint on the same grounds, actually. If you were a Muslim saying Muhammad was in Isaiah 42, I would say the same. Now, I'm not saying, therefore, Muhammad isn't in Isaiah 42, but that's a different subject. But so I'm not being entirely consistent, I would agree, just to give you, just throw that point in your favour. But I'm always very wary of religiously committed inerrantist Christians insisting that Old Testament passages in some way reflect their faith, because usually the only people who say that are Christian fundamentalists who always already share their faith. No one else.
I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with that.
Because if it was independently true, Richard, of your theology, of your views, you and I could come up with at least one scholar in the world who agrees with you. And the fact that not you and I can't name a single specialist in this area anywhere who agrees with you, who is not sharing your presuppositions, speaks volumes. Because in the world of scholarship, there's going to be someone who might agree. And I don't know anyone who would agree that Daniel wrote Daniel based on entirely non-Christian presuppositions.
Yeah. I mean, I only have access to some of the major commentaries. You know, I've not read every work out there. But broadly speaking, yes, I think that's true.
It tells me a lot. It tells me an awful lot.
But what that tells me is that different groups are open to... take politics, right? And I like, you know, so I'm a little bit of a fan of Jordan Peterson. And, you know, when he talks about economics, he says, look, the left is really good at pointing out the flaws, the great problem of inequality and the damage that can do to things like social fabric and well-being. And the right is really good at saying, actually, you've got to have a bit of a profit incentive to kind of keep the whole ball rolling. Now, sometimes you get a very polarized position. And I would say maybe this is true in scholarship, where either... you know, a passage cannot be prophetic because, you know, that's ridiculous. We don't think that anymore. That's not how Old Testament prophecy works. We've got this great alternative candidate.
That's not the reason. This is a canard. This is a straw man.
Okay.
That's not why scholars usually reject Daniel's authorship. Nothing to do with anti-supernaturalist bias, which is a Christian shibboleth. It's a straw man used to dismiss any critical views. I encounter this all the time on Blogging Theology as well from a certain person, Ken Temple. This is just based on the normal canons of historical research. There's no evidence that's talking about Jesus.
But canons of historical research, the principles are matched with flesh and blood individuals with presuppositions. But look, let me get to the key thing about the dating of Daniel, right? So I can completely see why, and look, I'm trying to be fair here. I can totally see why people think Daniel is, you know, post the supposed Daniel and is instead from, you know, third, second century, whatever. Yeah. And that's because they, you know, in large part, they think the timeline in Daniel 11 just goes really wrong. And I get that.
Yeah.
You know, I totally get that. And if I try and approach this without my Christian glasses, that would lead me to conclude this looks post Daniel.
Exactly.
If you counterbalance that with saying, but actually, if you try and come at this text in a neutral way and say, well, look, there's this supposed prophecy of 70 weeks. What might this be talking about? I don't think it fits Ananias as well as it does Jesus.
I do.
You know, trying to be neutral.
We have to disagree or disagree. I think it's nothing to do with Jesus. I think that's reading the shoehorning something that is unhistorical, completely alien to the context, and bringing in Christian presuppositions to determine exegesis. And I'm not convinced.
But if we actually look at the text, so it talks about 70 weeks. It talks about this individual being, you know, cut off, and then after that,
vanishing.
You're right. There's an individual who is yikareth, whatever that means. I would argue on linguistic grounds that's cut off, but
they just vanish. Yeah, it's not obviously talking about anyone.
Fine. They vanish in some, though, as I pointed out, even if you put aside the word, most commentators, according to Collins, Most critical commentators think it is an individual who was killed, which is Ananias the Third. So I think, you know, that would be in favour. And then after that, troops shall come and destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now, if we try and set now, I would argue that a more literal, if we interpret this more literally, it is a better fit for Jesus. Why? The 70-week time scale. And yes, I've acknowledged there are different places you can start in. Whichever one you go for, it is a better fit for Jesus. After Jesus is cut off, like Ananias, killed, cut off, yikarei, that's my interpretation. Then the city is destroyed, the destruction of the temple.
I don't see that. You're seeing that because of your Christian perspective. Your Christian glasses are reading that into the passage. I just don't see it. Now, and that's why it's not persuasive as, you know, come Mr. Muslim, come Mr. Secularist, believe in this prophecy. It is very, very, at best, tenuous and vague. And it's ultimate, it's open to many other more plausible historical interpretations than that. And so, you know, can I suggest, for the sake of momentum, that can I propose Isaiah 9, chapter 6 for our next discussion, moving on?
Well, I'm happy to discuss that, but I wonder, because you said you just don't buy it, but you've not actually addressed any of, you've addressed one of the specific details.
I don't find it plausible. I said it only has plausibility in your mind. It's an arbitrary thing to say it refers to Jesus when it's a fictional account written in the 3rd century BC. It's not real prophecy. As I said before, you're making a category mistake here. You're assuming it's prophecy, and it's not prophecy. It's a work of fiction. And to take fiction as prophecy is a serious error of interpretation. And I'm not budging on that, because I agree with 99% of the world scholars that this is not to be taken as a prophecy of Daniel. You're insisting to take it as Daniel. I'm saying that is not, there's a whole raft of issues here which tell against your position, from the authorship to the dating to the genre issue, interpretation, and your arbitrary designation of a guy centuries later called Jesus, over and over again. That I would challenge that. Therefore we're not going to get anywhere, because I'm just going to start off the basics. It's not by Daniel, and it's a work of fiction.
Well, that's fine. That's clearly the key thing, and we'll probably just have to leave that there.
Fair enough. So Isaiah 9:6. Now, Isaiah, interestingly, critical scholarship.
Well, actually, just before we go there, I don't know if that's Isaiah 9:6. I don't know if that's the best one to go for. In that, I don't think that's.
Is that not on your list?
It is. I tentatively would say that it's a direct.
It is on your list, along with Isaiah.
It is on my list.
In fact, you've got two references. In fact, you've got lots of references for Isaiah. 7:14, and we took them both, actually. 7:14 and Isaiah. I'm just choosing this because I think it is...
Because
you proposed it, which you did, but also because it is a text very frequently cited, almost as much as Isaiah 53, actually, which we'll come to, in this debate. But interestingly, as you will know, critical scholarship does accept that this passage... chapter 7 and 9 are by Prophet Isaiah, you know, from his time, from his, you know, these are authentic. So none of the issues before about fiction, about authorship obtained. Now we're dealing with some real hardcore actual text. And even though Isaiah, to my knowledge, is not mentioned in Islam, certainly not in the Quran, so I don't know if he's seen as a prophet or not. I just don't ask me. I don't know. I've not come across a reference to Isaiah. Nevertheless, I don't have a problem with him being a prophet. I will just say, though, before I mention this, quote this passage, that, as you know, mainstream scholarship, Christian scholarship, views Isaiah as a composite work. The book of Isaiah we have today is a composite work. The first 39 chapters are seen as historical, going back to Isaiah himself. Then we have Deutero-Isaiah, which is the second Isaiah, unknown authorship, written afterwards, which contains the famous Isaiah 53. And then there's even a third Isaiah as well, that's posited. But in these two texts, we're dealing with stuff that seems to be authentic. And I would say Christians have misinterpreted and misread, sometimes, usually not deliberately and culpably, because it's read in a certain way within the Christian tradition. But Christians who are conversant with the Bible and read it carefully, who still insist on this referring to Jesus or the future or the Messiah, I think are mistaken and are culpable, because it doesn't, in my view, refer to a Messiah at all. So coming to 9:6, I'll go back to the NRSV. Why not? The famous passage is, for a child has been born to us, a son given to us, authority rests upon his shoulders, and he is named Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. His authority shall grow continuously. There should be endless peace for the throne of David and his kingdom. He will establish and uphold it with justice and righteousness from this time onwards and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. So this is a messianic passage, according to Christians. Obviously, it's cited at Christmas time, December 25th. Lovely passage. I would say is absolutely nothing to do with Jesus at all. And all the indicators are to the contrary. And let me just give you why, several reasons why. Firstly, and this is just reading the passage, we need to note the tense. This is referring to an event, a child who has already been born. It's a past tense. It's an historic event rather than, it's not prophecy in the Christian sense of prediction of the future. By the way, biblical prophecy isn't like Christian understanding of prophecy at all. And you'll know this, Richard. Prophecy usually addresses contemporary events, the society in which they live, pointing out injustice, bringing God's judgment on people. It's not, oh, in 1,000 years' time, X will happen. That's not biblical prophecy. Normally, there are some exceptions, but usually biblical prophecy is not predictive. It's to do with addressing the contemporary world. So Isaiah is addressing the righteous reign of the coming king who has already been born. So who is the identity of this person? Well, the identity is variously suggested. King Hezekiah's son are very plausible candidates, but it has nothing to do with Jesus. I mean, you'd have to shoehorn it in from a completely different religion, Christianity, and say, aha, it is this, to get there. But you won't from an historical reading come, it's not about a Messiah, doesn't mention a Messiah, of course. It's about an event that's already happened in Isaiah's day. It's not about the future. It has nothing to do with Christianity at all, unless you read it with particular glasses that ignore those issues that I mentioned, the historical context and the tense of the passage. So that would be my opening salvo on this.
Okay, excellent. So yeah, there's a key point there, actually, which is, what is the nature of biblical prophecy? Paul, you accepted that there might be some occasions where prophecy is about the future, but generally you say it's kind of about the present. I mean, I think that from the portrayal, whether or not these are actually inspired books or not, the portrayal in the Old Testament is often about things in the immediate future. So this thing will happen in a few years and 10, 20 years. Okay. But there is still that claim to be kind of prophesying things in the future. I would say that actually, I found this as I was kind of preparing for today and reading some critical commentaries on some of these messianic prophecies. I found on one or two occasions scholars saying this cannot be about Jesus because prophecy is not about that far in the future, which slightly begs the question, which is, if we take those passages and say, well, it can't be that because that's not the nature of prophecy, you're not letting those passages inform our understanding of prophecy and what is acceptable interpretation. So there's a little bit of, I don't know, the chicken and the egg there. But yes, in terms of this passage, I didn't get around fully to looking at kind of what's the major critical view on this. Hezekiah is certainly a popular option. Whether that's in a messianic sense, that they thought that Hezekiah would be kind of the final righteous Davidic king, that's another aspect to discuss. But there are some senses, even in proto-Isaiah, that something more than just a normal king is coming. So Isaiah 7:14, whatever's going on there, and that's a tricky passage. It is interesting that in Isaiah 18, it talks about something coming and filling the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. Emmanuel is the one who owns the land. It's quite a striking description there. In Isaiah 9, we do have this amazing passage for, you know, to us a child is born, a son is given, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, do you take this in a quite metaphorical way in light maybe of Psalm 45, although that's debatable? Do you understand this in light of, you know, Psalm 82 and Exodus, even though those are very different contexts? what I would say is commentators have struggled with this, how to divide up this text. Effectively, I would say even secular scholars have struggled with the fact that these do seem to be very exalted titles, yet they seem to be predicated of a human king. And they've addressed that in different ways. Is this kind of an accession hymn like Psalm 45? Is there some influence of other societies like Egypt going on?
Yeah.
Those are possible. It is also possible that this is meant quite literally, and both of those will be on the table. And so that there are enormous bigger questions of, are we allowed to interpret this in light of other passages? How do we understand Jews and how they relate to other cultures? How willing are they to use kind of pagan language and imagery? Sorry, and just to finish in terms of the broader context, this also comes, so there's Isaiah 7, Isaiah 9 and Isaiah 11, where it talks about, does it talk about the stump of Jesse? Stock of Jesse, a branch shall grow out from his roots, which I thought was quite commonly, even in secular understanding, understood to be messianic in some sense. Not saying it's about Jesus, but kind of an expected idealized Davidic king. And so within that context of Isaiah 7 and Isaiah 11, it is very plausible that Isaiah 9 is also understood as being an idealized Davidic king. Now, the question is...
I agree with you.
From a secular perspective, maybe they hoped that that would be Hezekiah.
Yep.
From a canonical, from a secular perspective, maybe it's that. From a non-supernatural perspective, it can't be about Jesus. From a non-committal perspective,
well, there's no evidence it should be. It doesn't mention Jesus. It's a random, arbitrary. I could say it's about Muhammad. I could say it's about Hare Krishna. I could say it's about some guy in China. I mean, there is no. There's nothing in the passage to indicate any of these. It's an arbitrary designation.
So at the time it's written, you know, Jesus, the Son has not become incarnate. Jesus Christ of Nazareth has not come into being. So, yes, of course. But if we take a non-committal perspective that this is about the future, it is only in the future, once it's fulfilled, that we can see this is the individual that's spoken of.
There's two things here. One, I've got to go to the toilet. Sorry.
Okay.
And secondly, it's in the past tense, the passage. It's
past not, tense, yes.
So, excuse me, I'm going to have to just go somewhere.
Okay, in a bit. We'll pick it up in a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm going to turn my camera off so you don't just sit here looking at me.
Thank you.
Hello.
Okay.
So one of the issues is about the past tense. So a number of commentators, Gesenius, one of the classical Hebrew grammar figures, I think Walt Keane O'Connor in their work, do talk about the and there are different terms that are used for this, but you know, the prophetic perfect or the I think other terms are sometimes used, which is how the future can be spoken about in the past tense. I would also say, and this I can speak with slightly more authority with my own knowledge of biblical Hebrew, is that, you know, scholars debate exactly what's going on in terms of tense and aspect. In English, you know, we talk about tense. We say, I am sitting, I will sit, I was sitting, past present, future. Hebrew is more nuanced in that certain verb forms, the perfect and the imperfect, if you want to call them that, can talk about tense, I will go and do this, or it can talk about aspect or process, has an action been done or is it in the process of been doing. So Hebrew verbs and tenses are a bit complex in that regard. So look, there's a broader issue there about, is there such a thing as the prophetic perfect, as these grammarians have noted? Maybe that's controversial in more recent secular scholarship. I don't know. I'd love to know more about that if Paul, no, you do, or anyone else does.
You make a valid point about the Hebrew tenses, you know, the prophetic past, etc. I take that. It's usually translated in the Jewish Bible, the NISV, as in the past tense, but you could say, well, maybe it's referring to a future event. You could argue that. The thing about the name, by the way, the Mighty God, Wonderful Counselor, etc., is an interesting comment from the Jewish Study Bible on that title. This long sentence is the throne name of the royal child. Semitic names often consist of sentences that describe God. So in this translation, it's actually in inverted commas, this title. So the words, the Mighty God is planning grace, the Eternal Father, a peaceable ruler, is in inverted commas, designating a title rather than a description of the individual. It's a name that people have. For example, he gave the example, Isaiah in Hebrew means the Lord saves. Now, it's not therefore a designation that Isaiah the man was the Lord. It's just, this is a Semiticism. This is something that happens. And yeah, give other examples, some Akkadian and so on, which I won't bore you with. So this is a recognized convention. Christians have read this or misread this as a literal description of the individual, which is, again, a genre issue. This is one of the benefits of biblical scholarship, to try and uncover the historical contextual meaning, is that it can illuminate these issues. So it's mistaken to read it as a description of the individual, but as a Semitic well-known convention in the ancient Near East, where, like Isaiah himself, it means the Lord saves. So it's a mistake to read that as a description of an individual.
So, okay, a few things there. Appeals to Akkadian and other things like that, you know, this may be true in other societies. You'd also have to look at those other societies and whether that, you know, later on the Romans or the Egyptians, and did they actually think their rulers were in some sense divine?
I think Isaiah was the Lord. Isaiah means the Lord saves.
Let me come to Isaiah in just 1 second. So it's always instructive for the conceptual boundaries of what the text could mean to look at parallel societies, but also we need to understand, well, what did Israelites think? Israelites who, to some, you know, some extent were influenced by, but also reacted against other societies, particularly when it comes to things like, you know, deification and monotheism. So yes, Isaiah, means, you know, the Lord saves, but that's clearly the Lord saves. It's a reference, you know, you are named in honor of God. There's a difference between being called the Lord saves and being called the Lord, or here El Gibor, you know, Mighty God. There's a difference between a name which might be, you know, Mighty God Saves, which is clearly reflecting, isn't it amazing what God has done, and you know having that name. A Muslim, you know, would not be called Allah, right? Because that, you know, there might be some compound names that have Allah in them. I mean, I know Abdullah, I don't know what other examples there might be, you know, theophoric names. You get names that include the divine name, but aren't actually claiming the divine name. Whereas some of these terms, you know, do actually seem to be predicated of God himself, particularly Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Israelite Kings.
How do you decide that? Obviously, you're motivated by your Christian belief to say this. You're not a neutral, you know, you're very motivated by your own Christian presuppositions here to say this. You want this to talk about Jesus. But as the commentary says, Semitic names, so that's not just Jews, but, you know, a family of cognate Semitic languages, yeah, in the Middle East, often consist of sentences that describe God. And it gives example in the Hebrew scriptures and in Babylonian, Arcadian, and so on. So this is a common theme. This is not idiosyncratic.
Yeah.
But your insistence in this example, in Isaiah 9, somehow can't mean that. I would suggest is motivated.
I'm not sure prior, I said that.
By your prior, well, you, that's what you're saying.
Well, hold on. Sorry.
What's
sorry
your, you're saying sometimes it says it's taken literally, and of course, then you're going to you're not just a segue into this is referring to Jesus, although you mentioned Jesus.
So I'm trying to say, so from my understanding, from my reading of secular commentaries on this, it seems to be a tricky text that there's no easy solution for. So just saying, oh, it's just like any other theophoric name, I'm trying to say, is not a, maybe it's true, it's not an easy solution. And similarly, the example
what,
you
this just... This is, I mean, I'm just going by one reputable academic source.
It is a reputable source. The nature of a study Bible is, they do tend, and I've got study Bibles as well. They do tend, I've got the Jewish Study Bible. They only have a certain amount of space to discuss these things. And so sometimes they will, you know, go with what might be their preferred solution and present that as the clear solution.
Is it true or is it false in your view then that it says here Semitic names often
just to finish
that describes, are you saying that's false? Are you saying
just to finish my point, I'm trying to say if you actually, you know, scholarly commentaries have a lot more space to deal with these issues in depth, right?
I think you're not addressing the issue here, Richard. Is that statement are you saying that statement is false? The claim that Semitic names often consist of sentences that describe God and they give example. Are you saying then that is false, that statement?
No, that's true. But whether that adequately explains what is going on here, scholars in commentaries where they devote a lot of text to this issue wonder if that is sufficient and adequate to explain what is going on here. And that's why they've tried to say, well, maybe some of the names
you apply here,
to
God, you mean
some of them to the king.
You mean Isaiah 9?
In Isaiah 9, 6, yes.
So why do you think it's not going on? Why do you think then, given that this is a very common occurrence where people have the divine name without it being God himself, why is Isaiah 9:6 an exception to this generality then, in your view?
So again, I'm not saying it necessarily is, and I do need to finish my thoughts if that's okay. I'm trying to say Isaiah 9 can be understood in two different ways. And from a secular perspective, I don't know which one you go for, right? So from a secular perspective, I'm trying to say maybe what you're saying is the solution, but maybe it's not. And secular scholars have actually struggled with this, and it is clearly a difficult passage. Now, the specific example...
Okay. Pardon? We're just staying with an historical reading here. It's not to do with religion, this, like secular...
No, I agree. Religion.
It's to do with historical method, which looks at the historical context and the cultural cross-references.
Yes.
It's not a question of, because in my mind the word secular is bad. I'm not a secularist, as speaking as me. I reject secularism. I personally do. So when you say this reading is a secular, I'm thinking,
sorry, historical critical.
I don't agree with secular readings. I believe in a metaphysical reality.
I misspoke. Historical critical commentaries have struggled with this passage. Maybe the solution the Jewish Study Bible highlights is the right one. Maybe it's not. Now, I am uncommitted.
Why is this to do? Because this is your argument. You reference this as a text to do with Jesus. And I'm just wondering, what is your evidence for it to be?
Okay, so for context. So I sent you a list of a number of texts, and I will believe in those with different degrees of certainty. Okay. Uh-huh. Also, that list, I think broadly speaking, you know, I believe that you can make a historically credible argument for them. It fits in the context well. But yes, maybe some of those, I think, in light of the person of Jesus, it more clearly seems to be about him. To address specifically, you're asking me purely from a historical critical perspective. Maybe it's prophecy, maybe not. Let's just take the text as it stands. If you just were to use that approach, I don't know. I need to research it more. But I'm trying to say the scholars I've been reading who use the historical critical methods, these are the mainstream academic commentaries, they acknowledge this is a difficult text. There have been many proposed solutions. Now, you raised one solution and you mentioned Isaiah. As I mentioned, Isaiah means the Lord saves. There is a difference between a name being the Lord saves, which in the third person refers to God and his activity. That's fine. There's a difference between that and having a name, which is actually a title of God, such as Mighty God. Yeah. Does the Jewish Study Bible you have in front of you, maybe it does, does it have any good examples where some of the actual titles of God are ascribed to people?
Yes. The actual name of God. Sorry, what is the actual name of God? I missed that.
Okay, where one of kind of the titles or names of God are actually predicated of
I mentioned Isaiah, the Lord saves. Okay.
So there, the name is talking about God in the third person and his activity, the Lord saves. It is not in any way...
We're losing the plot here, with respect. Okay. You gave me this passage as an example explicitly of an Old Testament prophecy of Jesus. Those are your words, not mine. I'm looking in this passage to see if I can see a prophecy of Jesus of Nazareth. Yeah. We agreed that we would start with an historical critical approach to these texts without in any way prejudicing any other readings.
Which is not what I was doing in that list. That list was, what do I, as a Christian, trying to be fair to these texts, but also taking all of the Old Testament together, understand? Right. That list is doing something different to our conversation now.
I'm looking, we're going through it one by one. We're starting with the historical critical reading. It's the second text we've looked at. And I'm looking at Isaiah 9:6, and also the other passage, which I'm very happy to go into, Isaiah 7:14, which is very clearly not about Jesus as well. And I just don't see any prophecy, to use your words, of Jesus of Nazareth. I see that, I've read you the historical critical interpretation of those passages, which pretty much fills out and exhausts the meaning on an historical level. I'm not ruling out sensus plena or what you call typology. If you
What I'm discussing here.
In our postmodern universe, you can do that, but we are at the moment restricting ourselves to an historical reading. I do not see on an historical reading, which you and I accepted as our starting point, any reference to Jesus at all. There are many, many perfectly normal, plausible, without straining ourselves, explanations to account for all the component parts of this passage, including the divine name. As I say, it is Semitic names often consist of sentences that describe God. Thus, they give Isaiah, they talk about Arcadian examples and other examples. That's fine. For me, I have no further interest in that passage. I'm certainly not thinking, oh my God, maybe Christianity is true. Yeah. Christianity has absolutely nothing to do with this passage on an historical, critical understanding.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
But I don't think we've got to the root of our disagreement, which is, does the example given by the Jewish Study Bible match the kind of language that we have here? The example that you just gave, and maybe there are more in the Jewish Study Bible, which I'd love to hear.
They say it does. They say this is an example.
Well, that's their opinion. Other scholars,
It's their opinion, but what evidence have you got to refute this opinion?
Okay, so number one, if we're appealing to authority.
No, I'm not. Not authority. What evidence have you got that this passage is actually referring to Hezekiah being the mighty God and the everlasting Father, which I think... In a Jewish context, unbelievable. You're not going to get...
So the evidence...
Isaiah is the most monotheistic chapter in the whole of the Bible. It's not going to be talking about Hezekiah being the Almighty God.
So the evidence I'm not... Right now, in our conversation, I'm not trying to say this is about Jesus or anything. I'm just trying to say that the solution proposed by the Jewish Study Bible, I take issue with. What is my evidence? My evidence is that the argument and the specific example that you have just given, Isaiah, to me, does not seem to match very well what we find here. Isaiah means the Lord saves.
Why does it not match? In that specific passage, why is it not... Why is the explanation it just being a common way of describing, why is that?
Let me put it this way. Is it an appropriate Muslim name for a Muslim to be called Allah saves?
I don't know. I'm not going to get into Islam here because Islam is a whole different kettle of fish.
Let's do this.
Historical exegesis.
Islam
has nothing to do with this.
Fine. I'm trying to give an analogy. Is it appropriate?
I hate analogies, but anyway.
It is appropriate to have a name called the Lord saves. Is it appropriate to have a name called the Lord? I go around saying, my name is the Lord.
You're asking me, in the time of Isaiah, in the historical critical context, was that possible? I don't know. I'm not an Old Testament specialist. However, to have the title translated, quote, the mighty God is planning grace, the eternal father, a peaceable ruler, in inverted commas, is, according to these experts, a perfectly acceptable Semitic way of naming someone. So your example of the Lord is not actually the issue here. The issue is it's a long title. The mighty God is planning grace. No one's going to say.
Sorry. Okay.
That's the example. Your argument is based on irrelevancy, actually, because no one's proposing that anyone called anyone God in this passage such.
I think I was misunderstanding. So it depends how you break these up. Are these separate? Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, or is it the Wonderful Counselor is Mighty God? Or what did you say? The Mighty God is.
They're translating, and of course, one can disagree on translate. So in inverted commas, this is the title. He has been named, quote, the mighty God is planning grace, the eternal father, a peaceable ruler, unquote. That's his title. Grace. No one's going to think. That this person is that. It's a title given to people in the Semitic way that the people did in those days. That's the argument.
That's fine. Sorry, yeah, I was misunderstanding you. I didn't realize how important. To the argument, which is how we take these titles. So I'm going to need to plead agnosticism. I don't know if the mighty God is planning grace is a natural or good translation of the Hebrew there.
I'm relying on the experts here. This is an argument from authority, I grant you, because I have to defer, like when it comes to a doctor, when it comes to disease.
Do you recognize that scholars disagree on their solutions to this passage? Not all scholars would agree with the Jewish study Bible.
But that is a million miles from saying it's talking about Jesus and it's a messianic prophecy, which is your claim, the whole reason we're talking about it in the first place.
It's not right now. That's not what I'm claiming.
Okay.
Right now, I was just trying to say that the Jewish study Bible solution might be true, but scholars disagree about this and I have my doubts. But I have acknowledged that I misunderstood something. Okay. And I need to go away and look more at the grammar and see is the mighty God whatever it was, wonderful planner, whatever it was, is appropriate. So let's leave that there. Okay. I need to do more Hebrew grammar.
That's fine. So coming back to Isaiah 7, 14, which is pretty much part of the same book, obviously the famous verse is, look, the young woman is with child and shall bear a son and shall name him Emmanuel. And another very famous Christmas verse read at Christmas time in churches all across the world. Lovely verse. But if you just read it in context, and indeed the New Revised Standard Version, a Christian translation, gives us the context. Isaiah gives Ahaz the sign Emmanuel. Again, it says in verse 10, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign of the Lord your God. Let it be deep as Sheol or high as heaven. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, and I will not put the Lord to the test. Then Isaiah said, hear then, O house of David, is it too little for you to weary mortals that you weary my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign, whether you like it or not, he seems to be saying. Look, the young woman is with child, shall bear a son, and shall name him Emmanuel. He shall eat curds and honey by the time he knows how to refuse good, the evil, and choose the good. So this is one of your messianic prophecies, quote unquote, of Jesus. I would suggest a very natural historical reading is precisely what this Bible says it is. This is Isaiah giving Ahaz a sign of Emmanuel, despite Ahaz saying he doesn't want a sign. He's going to get one anyway. Why Emmanuel, God with us? Well, as we know, Semitic names often consist of sentences or words that describe God. It does not mean that this chap is literally the offspring is literally Emmanuel. So I would say that your claim that this refers to Jesus is totally arbitrary and unhistorical, and it requires a shoehorning of later Christian beliefs into a completely different environment, a Jewish text. So I would argue that you've not in any way suggested from this passage it talks about Jesus.
Okay, so again, the list I sent you, that was done from my Christian perspective. We're now having a conversation. I'm trying to bracket my Christian perspective as best I can, and I'm just trying to say, let's just try and understand this text on its own terms. Maybe it's just kind of a human king at that time. There's a bit of disagree. There's a bit of disagreement about who the son might be. Is it the prophet's sons? Is it an anonymous son? You know, the point being, women at this time who have children before they grow up to a certain age, you know, these things will happen. That's all fine. I completely agree with you, Emmanuel. So this is a good example of what we were saying. Theophoric name. God is something. So in this case, God is with us. Absolutely. That can be predicated of a human without anything more than that. So completely agree. The key interpretative issue here, well, there are a couple. The Lord will give you a sign. Mm-hmm. Often in the Old Testament, sign is actually something quite miraculous, something quite wonderful. Whereas just the birth of a human child, not of a virgin, just any old child is born, grows up to, you know, a few years old, isn't actually that miraculous. So that's a small argument there.
An argument for what?
That something more might be going on here, that this might be more than just a normal birth of a, you know, any old, you know, human person like the prophet's child, something more significant.
On that point, in verse 14, which you've just quoted, therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Who is the you in that passage?
The Lord. So that's Ahaz to whom he's talking. Well, actually, hold on. The Lord himself will give you a sign. Let me just double check.
My argument is, you, it's pretty obvious who you is. It's referring to someone in that generation of Isaiah. It is not, it cannot be referring by any normal grammatical historical reading to a future event in Galilee in, 700 years later? That is a completely fantastic reading, completely violates any normal grammatical historical rules of interpretation. I will stress that you said that these are Old Testament prophecies of Jesus. This is your example of a prophecy of Jesus. I would say, if you look at it in detail, that's why I asked you, therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Is it talking about the Galileans in the first century AD by a normal historical reading of that text? Because that is what you are claiming, Richard, about first century Judea. I'm saying it's talking about Isaiah's own time, seven centuries before.
I need to stress again, because we keep coming back to this. I sent you a list based upon my Christian reading of the Old Testament, which will include taking all of it canonically. We are now doing something different, and you have brought up Isaiah 7:14. I would not bring this up as one of the best passages for us to look at with the method we are now using. I'm happy to do so because it's interesting. Yeah, but
with respect, you mentioned this text. I've got a quote here. I can see it listed as an Old Testament prophecy of Jesus, quote unquote, Isaiah 7:14. You did. Not, this is one of your proof texts, not one of my texts.
In a spreadsheet I sent you, where I was using a different methodology to what we are now doing in this discussion, right? Now, I'm happy to discuss it in this context, and let me explain. Basically, I think there are a number of interesting things in this text, and there are different ways you can understand it, right? So, who is the you that is being spoken of in verse 14? The Lord himself will give you a sign. Now, interestingly, you there is not singular. It is plural. Okay, so who is this talking to? Is it just Ahaz and those standing around? Well, maybe. It doesn't talk about anyone standing around. It's interesting that in verse 13, it says, "Hear then, O house of David." Mm-hmm. So it is not impossible, it is not necessarily implausible, that in this context, when it says a sign for you, the you plural is actually the house of David, including Ahaz. He's the person immediately before him. Right. But could there be a sense in which this is a sign for the entirety of the house of David and its future?
That's interesting, because you seem to have, I'm not sure that's an historical reading, because Isaiah then said, after the skepticism of Ahaz, Isaiah said to who is in verse 13, then Isaiah said, "Hear then, O house of Israel, David." Well, this is obviously the Israelites, because they are part of the people who are descended from King David. So he's talking to his contemporaries, obviously. And he thinks, is it too little for you to weary mortals than you weary my God also? Okay. But he's addressing his contemporaries with this question, and Ahaz. Therefore, Isaiah says, the Lord will give you, who is you? You, the very people who doubted or dismissed the idea of having a sign at all. This is a very generational bunch of people who had issues with God that Isaiah is addressing. It's not talking about some kind of eternal house that goes way into the future. That would undermine the whole logic of the narrative, which is to do with these people just basically not accepting God.
But a number of scholars, and I don't think just conservative ones, you know, notice that there's some kind of conceptual link going on between different passages, right? So let me just finish before you respond, because otherwise I don't think you'll be responding to what I'm actually, you know, saying. So you know, you get 7:13, 7:14, you then get mention again of Emmanuel in chapter 8, verse 8. It talks about a flood coming that will spread on into Judah as a flood and pouring over, reach up to the neck. Its outspread wings will fill the breadth of your land. O Emmanuel, your land, Emmanuel. Is that quite a strong thing to use of a human ruler? Well, we need to look at the rest of the Old Testament. You then get Isaiah 9 and the description there, and then you get Isaiah 1, which I think, generally speaking, I think most scholars would say is messianic. So the key question is, are these passages related? Do you have, in quite quick succession, three or four passages which culminate in the messianic hope and which are all about what is going to happen to the Davidic dynasty? Now, look, maybe that's what's going on here. Maybe it's not. Maybe you're right. I don't know. I'm just saying these are some interesting passages.
I'm saying that we must remember always the claim here that you're saying that there are Old Testament passages which clearly prophesy Jesus. Those are your words. I'm saying if you read Isaiah 7, it is Isaiah giving Ahaz the sign of Emmanuel. Isaiah is giving a contemporary of his a sign from God because of da-di-da-di-da. It is not a prophecy in the sense that you intend it to be of a Jesus who would be, you know.
I'm not talking about Jesus. I'm talking about some kind of.
I am, because that is okay. Why we're having this conversation in the first place.
But we're having two conversations, because I started off the list I composed for you. Was about, here are some verses which I, as a practicing Christian, when I take the Old Testament and the whole of its canonical context, understand to be messianic prophecies. As we've had this video, you said, no, we're not doing that. We're not taking canonical context. We're taking off our religious lenses.
Yeah. You said with respect, and I'm reading your text now, you didn't give me all that long. I mean, I understand what you're doing, but you said these were Old Testament prophecies of Jesus. And I'm saying, well, let's look at these in their historical context. And they're not prophecies of Jesus. If you want to read them in a Christian way, you're free to do so. But let us be honest that that is not the primary meaning of these texts, that you are doing eisegesis or eisegesis, as the WAG put it, rather than exegesis, which is getting the text to speak for itself. And I think you're doing eisegesis. I'm trying to do exegesis. Exegesis does not support your view. Eisegesis, of course, would support your view. It also supports the view that Muhammad is spoken of in Isaiah 42, Deuteronomy 18:18.
Ah, well, people will have to read my article on that, won't they?
Yeah, but you can. If you eisegesis means you're reading stuff into the text. And if you want to do that, anyone can do anything. It is open season. Open season for any religious group in the world to see anything they want in the text. And people do that. But if we're controlling it by a natural historical reading, then none of these texts, we haven't been the author of them all, including Isaiah 53, speak of Jesus at all. Yeah. That's my argument.
Well, look, what I've been talking about for the last 15, 20 minutes on this text and our general whole discussion now in this video has been not using a Christian lens or even a canonical lens, but just trying to understand what the historical author is saying. Yeah. And with that in mind, with that approach, I am not claiming Isaiah 7:14 is about Jesus. I'm saying, I don't know, maybe it's talking about, maybe that, because Old Testament scholars who are not conservative Christians will say there is the messianic hope in the Old Testament. They're not saying it's Jesus. No. Yeah, good. And I'm saying Isaiah 7:14 in the context of Isaiah 8:8, in the context of Isaiah chapter 9, in the context of Isaiah 11, might Isaiah 7:14 also be part of that messianic hope? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know.
Because you're ignoring the passage context itself. The context is very clear. Isaiah is giving Ahaz a sign of Emmanuel. You ignore that, and then you empty the passage of any content, and then you bring in other passages and say, Messianic, Isaiah 1 is Messianic. You bring those in, and you fill up that empty space with your preferred Messianic prophecies, completely obliterating the plain immediate context, which is very clear that he's talking about someone in Isaiah's own day.
I'm not necessarily disputing that. Maybe it's about Hezekiah. Maybe Hezekiah was a messianic figure. That's all I'm saying right now. Yeah,
there are lots of messiahs in the Bible. It's not Jesus. Forget about Jesus. I mean,
I'm not talking about Jesus right now.
No, you've got non-Jews who are messiah in Isaiah, famously Cyrus, the king of, you've got non-Jews who are called the messiah. So there are lots and lots of messiahs, as there are lots of sons of God in the Bible, in the Jewish Bible. Yeah. Christianity has narrowed it down to only one person. They're called Jesus of Nazareth. But biblically, that's not the case. You could have many other sons of God and messiahs as well. The list is quite long, all the kings of Israel, for a start, messiahs, I mean. So okay. I think maybe, just to draw a line under this whole thing here, because I think we need some clarity here. My view is this, I don't know if you're going to agree, before we go any further with any other passages, on a historical critical reading of the Old Testament, we're not going to see Jesus of Nazareth. He's never mentioned in the Jewish Bible. On a Christian reading of the Old Testament, yes, he is there in Isaiah 9. He's there in all these passages you mentioned, Isaiah 53, he's there. I get that. If you're looking at it with a presupposition of a Christian, you're going to see him there. And I can see why you see him there if you have certain presuppositions. So because I'm not a Christian, I don't have to adopt your premises because they're not required by the text. They come from your religion. You're bringing them into the text. So it's same with Isaiah 53. You know, I have arsenals of evidence here for mainstream Christian scholars to say, which, you know, it's not what you think it says. But in a sense, that's beside.
Agreed. Yeah, mainstream scholarship says Isaiah 53 is not about Jesus.
These are Christian scholars who believe Jesus is the Son of God and die for their sin. Now, these people are motivated to see him there, but they still don't see him there on a historical reading. So these people, you know, if anyone's going to see it, they're going to see it, and even they don't see it. So on a Christian reading, however, you get 100%, you're right, and I can't challenge you by definition, because I can't, you know, if you want to be a Christian and read these in a Christian way, that's your entitlement. You can do that. And I'm not going to say you can't, because you can. But that's what your religion does. But if I employ the normal canons of historical scholarship, and that's not anti-supernaturalist liberal scholarship, it's to do with exegesis of the text. Isaiah 9:6 is clearly exegetically, in a normal reading, it's about Isaiah's own time. You're not going to find Jesus. Now, what I like about Dale Martin's approach, professor at Yale University, he's just recently retired, professor of the New Testament, is that what I have just said is basically what he just said in his most recent work. And I like his conceptual, theoretical way of doing this. So he would agree with me on everything I've said. He would also agree with you on your Christian beliefs as well. Now, he thinks this is okay. The whole purpose of the book is, how can you be a Christian, believe Christian things about the Bible, given what we know from biblical scholarship? And that's why I got the book, because he addresses this. This is the most important single question, I think, one of the most important questions to ask. And he has, I mean, you could be rude and say, he's having his cake and eating it. He's having it both ways. He is. But he would admit that. He would say, yes. He says the only reason he says this, that he can be a Christian, is because he's a postmodernist. That's what he says. Postmodernism means that he can do both and accept both. He can both be a really top-notch biblical scholar. And do you know, about Bart Ehrman, he agrees with everything Bart Ehrman says. I mean, he says that. He and Bart Ehrman are good friends, and he agrees with Bart Ehrman's approach, yeah? But he also believes that Jesus is the Son of God, the second person of the Trinity. He believes that Christ founded the church, that he is divine, blah, 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 blah. He believes that. And I'm thinking, what? How can you say all this? That's the book. He attempts to answer. Now, whether or not you think his answer is really coherent, I would question that. And I've written, that's a different subject, but I think he is having his cake and eating it. But his answer is postmodernism. On one level, he can say, I believe. Another level, I can say, no, it's not there. At the same time, he can hold these levels in tension. What you're trying to do, I think, is not quite that. You're trying to harm. You're trying to integrate them into one Weltanschauung. And I don't think that works, theoretically, intellectually. But Dale Martin's thing does work in that he is honest about the Bible, not saying what Christians think it says, but also saying it does say what Christians think. Because for example, the passages in Paul where Paul seems to not say that Jesus is God, you know, there's one God, the Father, and so on. He says, I choose to read these quite openly as a Christian, in a Christian way. So he interprets it. Now, he knows on historical critical reading what Paul says, but he chooses also to read it in a Christian way to conform with Trinitarianism, Council of Nicaea, Council of Chalcedon. So he acknowledges both. And I kind of respect that, because if he was in your chair now, I wouldn't have much to say to him because we'd agree. actually.
Oh, that'd be too boring, wouldn't it?
No. I mean, even though I disagree with his theology, we wouldn't disagree on the Bible, but he'd still say Jesus was God. He'd still say these passages talk about the Christian Messiah, but he'd also agree with me that historically they didn't. Now, how you deal with that proposed solution, you know, I personally find it a bit too clever. And a bit to having a cake and eat it, to be honest. Raymond Brown said that as well about, no, it was Giza Vermish, that was it, you know, from Oxford. Giza Vermish said that about Raymond Brown, you know, the New Testament scholar, because Raymond Brown, obviously a top-notch biblical scholar, Union Theological Seminary, great Johannine scholar, in terms of scholarship, completely critical. And yet he believed Jesus was God. He believed that Christ founded the church. He was a Catholic priest. I met him. He's actually a Roman Catholic priest. And Giza Vermish said, he had tried to have his cake and eat it. He had to have it both ways, affirming and yet, you know. And I think, actually, I agree with Giza Vermish, and I agree with him about Dale Martin as well. It's a bit sleight of hand. But at least they're honest in their sleight of hand. that's my point. And that's kind of a position I can kind of do business with, because it can say, Jesus is God. Yeah, Jesus is talking about in these passages. But no, he's not really historically, but theologically he is. As Christians, he is, but historically he's not. And you have these different levels in a postmodern discourse kind of way. You can do that in our modern world. You can say there's truth in this. Overall, that's kind of my worldview. But I think you're trying to collapse them into one kind of narrative, and I don't think that works.
Anymore. Yeah. So let me say I'm very much not a postmodern. I have in the past described myself as a pre-modernist. Very much not a postmodernist. I don't think we can, as the reader, impose a meaning upon the text. I don't think that's legitimate. We want to know, what did the author of this text intend? I think where we disagree is the way that you're characterizing my approach. I feel many times in this discussion I've tried to say, look, I've taken off my Christian glasses to the best of my ability, right? Subconsciously, who knows what's going on. And I honestly think this text might be portraying, you know, a divine Messiah, a suffering Messiah. Many times I've said, we don't know. And I feel often you have said, you've still got your glasses on.
Yes.
So, I
am saying that. I do believe that.
And I don't think we're going to agree about perhaps I'm a contact lens wearer, and we just cannot agree about whether I've still got them in.
I mean that disrespectfully, Richard. I'm just saying I really still think the presuppositions are operational, even though you think you've taken off your glasses. I think they're hardwired. It's not, you change the metaphor here, it's not your glasses, it's hardwired into your brain. And you can't but help interpret it that way, even though you think you're taking off the glasses, they're still there in some way in your neurons. They're still there. Yeah. That's my view.
Yeah. Perhaps I'm colorblind, and the only colors I see are Jesus and the Old Testament. It's just how I see the world.
That's another way of putting it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, we're probably not going to agree about what I'm doing, what I think I'm doing, what I, you know, etc. So yeah, that's that. I don't know if that's a natural pause, or if we want to get to Isaiah 53, what do you think's best?
That's a very good question. I think there's there's two answers. On one level, there's no point in talking about Isaiah 53, because I'm going to just exegete the passage in a way that is historically...
Could I ask one thing, which actually we might... I believe in one of your previous... And I mentioned this to you before we went live. I believe in one of your excellent, very informative videos you were reading from Bart Ehrman. I think it was his kind of introduction to the Bible. And he seemed to, and you quoted him as saying that most Old Testament scholarship sees the servant figure, the suffering figure in Isaiah 52:13 up to 53:12 as being the nation of Israel, or kind of a corporate understanding. Since we arranged this a couple of days ago, I've spent most of that time researching kind of what does, you know, what does mainstream biblical interpretation say about this passage? It seemed to me, from what I've been reading, that is a very esteemable approach with definite advantages, but actually most do think an individual is in view. Now, they don't think it's Jesus, but, Jeremiah, an unknown figure, perhaps the prophet himself.
Exactly. I was actually going to quote the New Jerusalem Biblical Commentary. They actually list the range of possible candidates for that. And you've listed, you're right, you've listed several of them. Whether or not Bar-Ehrman is right in his characterization, I don't really care, to be honest. I've never come across an Old Testament scholar who thinks it's about Jesus, on historical critical reading, that is. Now, it could be about, I've just never come across it. So
could I quote something there, if you don't mind? Yeah. So let me quote Mackenzie. And this is one of the editions of, I think it might be the older edition of the Anchor Bible Commentary on Jethro Isaiah. And he says, he says of the view that it's about Jesus, he says, in this form, the opinion is defended by no one today except in a few fundamentalist circles. This type of predictive prophecy does not appear in the Old Testament. And that's kind of all he says. So I would say that there's a hermeneutical choice there, which is obviously this massively depends upon how we understand the other, Zechariah 12:10 and Daniel 9, etc. But it also, even if those aren't about a suffering figure, there's also a thing about, can Isaiah have a slightly different understanding? Can Isaiah say something that other parts of the Old Testament don't necessarily say? So, and I'm not saying from a mainstream perspective, I'm not saying he's right or he's wrong. I'm just trying to highlight to our viewers that there is an interpretative choice there, which is what is plausible and what is not, before we even look at, what the detail, who fits the details. So,
I agree. It's just, I don't want to get into the Isaiah 53 thing, but it's not prophecy in my view. It's talking about a past event. It's not talking about a Messiah, never mentions a Messiah. No Jew ever, as far as we're aware, prior to the rise of Christianity, ever thought it was about the Messiah. Now, subsequent to that, there are some targums where they do identify it as a Messiah, but that arguably is under Christian influence. But prior to the rise of Christianity, no one was expecting this. Which really puts a question mark against these, when Paul says, and others in the New Testament say, look, it's in your Jewish scriptures, you stubborn Jews. Well, no one thought that. It's just, on a natural reading, it's not there. It's a totally unprecedented, unexpected, and ill-fitting claim. And so, of course, they wouldn't have expected it. Why would they? No normal person would. But just coming back to this, I'm not sure we need to proceed any further, because I'm going to, rehearse the arguments from impeccable Catholic scholarly sources, from Bar-Ehrman, from Jewish sources. When I say Catholic, also the New Revised Jerusalem Bible, which I really recommend. It's just come out, by the way. It's got the imprimatur of the Church on it. This is an excellent academic work produced by the Catholic Church. I was going to mention their comments on Isaiah 53, which are interesting. Yeah. Just to show that prominent Christian scholarship, as well as the Bar-Ehrman scholarship, all agree that in its historical context, it's not talking about Jesus. So the Christian claim that it is not backed up by your own scholars. I mean, it's like, I'm giving analogies, but, that is a whopping great big problem.
But what is that? I believe we've talked about, actually, informally, Facebook chats, not publicly. But I believe we agreed that Western Christianity is, saturated, to try and use a neutral term, with modernism and liberalism. And I believe you accepted that and lamented it, as do I. And so, to quote, and I've met many, I've been taught by, Catholic academics. I've been taught by someone who I think... was he involved in the New Jerusalem or one of the other ones? Anyway, I know some of these people, and I know their worldview, and it's a worldview which both of us would not accept.
But that's not an argument. That you see, what you're doing, they're doing, these are experts in the field. They are looking at, they're doing detailed study of the passages. They're coming up with cogent historical and linguistic reasons. It's not good enough to say, oh, well, they're modernists, as if somehow that produced false readings. When I look at the
multiple, won't it?
No, because when Bar, no, I don't see that. I don't see. I think this is ultimately an ad hominem attack, which is not a valid argument when it comes to this, because you're saying all the individual writers, which I'm sure you don't know them all, are somehow infected by an ideology that prevents them from seeing the truth. And I'm saying, when I look at their work, I judge that actually it's very sober and informative and historically acute. Yeah. That's my judgment.
Yeah.
You're saying that academia is worthless and is infected by an ideology that is hostile to your faith. And I think that's exaggerated. I think there's scholarship is, as you know better than I, is a spectrum, contains a spectrum of views. From the harshly skeptical and to the near or even the actual fundamentalists, I say that there's virtual unanimity on the original historical context of Isaiah 53 not referring to Jesus, but sensus pleno, typology, a la Dale Martin, you can have it. I'm not denying you can do that. Actually, I'm not saying that your view is wrong at that level, because that's a theological question, which is not what we're talking about. But on a historical basis, you're not going to, I don't think you have a leg to stand on.
That's fine. In terms of the appeal to authority, I agree. I would always much rather go to the actual arguments in the text than appeal to authorities. But in the light of your quoting and saying, look, even Christian and Jewish scholars say this, you have made that appeal. And therefore, I feel it's fair for me to highlight to the audience what you and I both know, and perhaps I would stress more than you would, which is, those Christians that are quoted, do not necessarily have the view of scripture that I do, or perhaps Orthodox Christians.
I've not said that. You're misrepresenting my views.
Okay, sorry.
I have not said that the author of the commentary in the New Jerusalem Biblical Commentary on Isaiah is a modernist. I don't know who it is, actually.
Okay, my apologies.
You are jumping way ahead of the evidence.
But we have discussed before and agreed that Western, even kind of Christian academics, are saturated with modernism. I thought we agreed that. Maybe we didn't.
No, I didn't. No, that's okay. Let me give you a brief summary. Who are the top biblical Christian scholars? Let's start. Tom Wright, N.T. Wright. There's no way on earth that Tom Wright is a modern.
Yeah, not Tom Wright.
You just dismiss him. Excuse me. These are some of the West's top biblical scholars in any category, whether you're talking about Christian scholars or just scholars per se. Tom Wright is not a modernist. I've never said that people like Tom Wright and people like him, F.F. Bruce would be another candidate. However, I can go for a long list: Craig Blomfield, F.F. Bruce, Howard Marshall, etc. Anyway, there are many others in my mind. These are not modernists. There are modernists. Bart Ehrman is about as modernist as you could possibly wish. And I think many of the authors in the New Jerusalem Biblical Commentary are actually modernists, including Raymond Brown. Actually, I would say he is. I would concede that.
It's more saying. Well, but I was saying.
You're saying a sweeping judgment. You're saying I thought all Westerners. No, I've never said that.
I'm talking generalities. Of course, the very conservative Protestant scholars you just quoted. Absolutely, they're very conservative. But we were talking in the context of the most popular mainstream commentaries and New Jerome biblical commentary and. Things like that, and you've just said the kind of contributors of Catholic things like the New Jerome thing are to some extent modernists. Was my point.
No, you're wanting to push me in a position here of generalizing. I won't be. I do not have a view, because I've not even looked at it, to be honest, about the Revised Jerusalem Bible Study Bible, which is as academic as the New Jerusalem Bible thing, the other thing.
Okay.
I think it'd be wrong. I'm not. So I'm saying that, as I've said, just to restate, there's a spectrum of views in New Testament scholarship. You know this, from the conservative to fundamentalist, all the way to the really radical. I've never characterized them all as being modernist. If I said that, I was wrong, and I renounce that view, and I absolutely don't tell that view now, if I ever did say it, because it is not true. And I know Craig Blomfield, his commentary on the Gospel of John, F. A. Bruce's work in general, et cetera, is very conservative. Okay.
They're on the conservative fringe. Okay.
Yeah. No,
do you think the majority of and look, I'm asking a genuine question. Maybe you'll say yes, maybe no. Do you think the majority of either the majority of popular New Testament academics or the majority of Catholic New Testament professors, whatever, do you think the majority of them are to some extent influenced by liberalism and modernism, or only some of them? What do you think?
The question needs finessing and nuancing. You say most, for whom? For what people? In America, people like D.A. Carson, Craig Blomfield, people associated with the Dallas who's that textual scholar?
Dan Wallace.
Dan Wallace. Now, Dan Wallace, You know, in that kind of world, Dan Wallace, I mean, he is, Bart Ehrman says, you know, he is the real thing. He's a good, very good textual critic. And he's about as conservative as you are, if not more so. So these people are not marginal figures in the world of public scholarship that people are aware of. And they produce lots of books and they do lots of videos and they have lots of students. These are major players in the United States. I would say they're probably much less influential than in Germany, shall we say, or in England or Oxford or Cambridge. But even at Cambridge, at Tyndall House, who's the new head of principal of Tyndall House? Okay. What's his name? Simon Cathaway, Ketra.
Gathercole.
Now, he's now a professor at Cambridge, and he's as conservative as you are. Is he not?
I don't know just how conservative, but yes, he is conservative.
So there's a spectrum, and they may be a minority, but they're certainly there, and they're vocal, and they produce stuff.
But we've been talking about, let's say, you know, Isaiah 53 or Daniel 9 or Isaiah 7. Do you think that most academics, whether they call themselves Christians or not, whatever they call themselves, do you think that most academics in, let's say, you know, secular institutions, not seminaries, in, you know, Germany, France, Britain, US, do you think most of them are influenced by liberalism and modernism in their thought?
Well, there's a huge question. You need to define what you mean by liberalism and modernism, and also which institutions in Germany, France, America are talking about. This is a huge, vast question that I've never spoken to an academic from Germany who's a New Testament scholar. I've read them, but I've never spoken to one. I've never asked them.
I don't know the answer.
But I will say that in the West, because I'm not a secularist, I'm not a modernist, I'm a traditionalist, to use the term, the Weltanschauung, or the spirit of the age, the zeitgeist, is secular, liberal, becoming more authoritarian in insisting that one subscribes to a list of beliefs to do with sexuality and alternative lifestyles and so on, and multiculturalism and you name it, which puts a huge amount of pressure on people, not just in theology, but in philosophy and as historians in general, and other people, to toe the line with penalties if you don't. You can lose your job, you can prosecute if you don't follow the line. So this is the terrible context that people are, not just academics, but all of us are having to live in. I agree. So, you know, whether or not that translates into how one interprets Isaiah 53, I think is a rather, you know, there's a tenuous link between the two. But certainly the ideological world we live in is very hostile to faith. I've said this in my last video, actually, hostile to Islam, obviously. Hostile to traditional Christians who actually stand up for what they believe in, whether it be on gay marriage or, you know, whatever. It's difficult, but I really question if that has a direct impact on the exegesis of Isaiah 53.
At the end of the day, I guess we'd have to look at, you know, an individual scholar and where they're coming from. A couple of times I've quoted scholars who have said this cannot be about Jesus because that's not how prophecy works, or this doesn't fit other passages, you know, in the Old Testament. And whether or not you agree with them,
we need details. Or what scholars?
Okay, well, I've quoted. So I quoted a minute ago from Isaiah 53, Mackenzie. So I quoted from Mackenzie earlier, who says about Isaiah 53, could it be talking about Jesus? And he says, in this form, that it's about Jesus, the opinion is defended by no one today except in a few fundamentalist circles. This type of predictive prophecy does not appear in the Old Testament. Yeah. And my point was just, you know, that's a worldview question, or that's an interpretative question, which one brings to Isaiah 53 based upon either how one has read other passages of the Old Testament, which, you know, we can debate. Perhaps there's also a bit of what is, you know,
I'm not sure what he means.
Can one predict the future? I don't know. Maybe that's what he's hinting at.
The two ways that I'm hearing that passage, you can interpret it. Either he's saying that predictive prophecy per se is no longer possible because presumably we're materialists and don't believe in prophecy anymore. Or he's saying that we can no longer argue that the Christian beliefs about Jesus are prophesied in the Jewish Bible because they're simply not there. If he's arguing the latter, I think he's right. I mean, talk the distinctive Christian beliefs about Jesus.
I don't think he's talking about that. He's talking about the category of predictive prophecy.
Well, it's clearly there in the Old Testament. There are plenty of passages that have predicted prophecy in them. I don't know what he means then. But, I mean, as a matter of fact, there are passages that predict stuff in the Jewish Bible.
I think what he's saying is the Old Testament does not, you know, predict things. Kind of maybe you said this earlier, I'm not sure, does not tend to. But he might say does not predict things hundreds of years in the future. It's kind of about the immediate,
yeah, I'm saying,
you know,
The usual Christian understanding of prophecy as predictive is simply not true, in that that's not what prophets are normally doing when you
normally,
see
the prophecy. No.
Yeah, but I'm not saying it's not an anti-supernaturalist comment. I'm just saying that's not what they normally portrayed as doing if you actually read the Bible. But there are predictive prophecies in the Bible, absolutely. And I'm not denying that. I'm just saying they're not the norm. It's just an empirical observation. It's not meant to be a theological point.
That's fine, but I'm just saying his perspective of that, I'm talking about him, not you, means that this individual passage in Isaiah 53 cannot be about Jesus, right? There cannot be an exception to what he thinks is the norm. And that in turn depends upon how one interprets these other passages, which some have seen about long distance predictions of an individual. That's my point.
Yeah, well, okay, if he's making a general, if he's simply saying Isaiah 53 is not prophecy and it's not about Jesus, he'd be absolutely right in my view. It's not, it's in the past tense, it's not about a prophet, it's not a prophecy, it's about Israel, it's nothing to do with, in his exile, nothing to do with Jesus. To say that it is not an historical reading, that's a Christian reading, which on another level is perfectly valid if that's what you do as a Christian. But as an historian, we cannot argue that because there's simply no evidence for it. It's to do eisegesis. And I think what you're doing, usually unconsciously perhaps, is eisegesis rather than exegesis. Even when you don't want to do eisegesis, I think you're doing eisegesis.
Maybe. God knows best. It'll be great to talk to you about Isaiah 53 at some point. Not even necessarily about Jesus, but just is it Israel, yeah. Is it, you know, corporate versus individualistic? I would be much more so, you know, as a Christian, I think it's about Jesus, even if I exclude that and exclude the possibility of it being Jesus. I would still prefer that it's about an individual rather than Israel. I really don't buy the Israel reading.
That's fine. I don't have any problems with that. I personally think it is about Israel. But if you want to think it's, there are plausible arguments of saying it's about Jeremiah or about Isaiah himself or whatever. And the there's a list in the New Jewish commentary of plausible candidates. But, you know, I don't have a horse in this race. It's not as if it matters to me at the end of the day if it's Isaiah or the nation of Israel.
That's true.
I don't have a horse. It's not of any theological interest other than to say that Christians use it to try and justify the idea of a Messiah that would die and rise from the dead as dying for people's sins. And I would say that is not a historical reading. That is a Christian reading, which no Jew prior to the rise of Christianity, as far as we're aware, ever thought was the case of that passage. It's a bidder. It's an innovation, a new thing. And that's why Jews didn't accept it, because it's simply not in their scriptures, according to them.
Yeah, I mean that's a big topic there, which is, you know, what did Jews before, you know, Christianity, before the first century Christianity, how did they understand Isaiah 53?
Exactly. And they didn't understand it in the way that Christians do at all. They saw it as a messianic figure who would die for the sins of the world. Yeah. I think, you know, when people quote Targums and whatnot, they keep on forgetting these are post Jesus.
In terms of before Jesus or at the time, but separate to Christianity, I think there are some
Before Christianity, before the rise of Christianity, as I've said already.
Okay.
As far as I'm aware, there is no evidence, extant evidence, that any Jew anywhere ever thought this was a messianic passage. It's simply no one thought it, apparently, according to the evidence. Now, of course, with the rise of Christianity, the idea is introduced. Some Jews were influenced by that, but it's a new idea. It was never so. You know, if God had given this passage to predict the coming of the Messiah, how come no one believed it was a Messiah? You know, it doesn't make sense. It's not clear to any Jews that it was about the Messiah, which is why they rejected Paul. When Paul, presumably, doesn't say he went around, but like, if he did go around talking about Isaiah 53, that's why they kicked him out, because this is not their faith. They weren't expecting this.
Yeah, just in terms of before, I think there might be, I need to brush up on this. I think there's a helpful summary in the New American Commentary on this. You know, there's talk about the teacher of righteousness in Qumran, and I'd have to double check if that's
BC. But that's not before the rise of Christianity, is it?
When is the because the community at Qumran stretched from BC into AD? I thought the teacher of righteousness was BC,
but we had to be careful here. The Qumran community, as you say, existed at the time of the rise of Christianity, but
also before.
Yes. It went back to what, a century or so BC. If you could find texts that I dated before the rise of Christianity, that would be interesting. But I've never seen, and I'm not aware of any scholars ever cited any evidence before the rise of Christianity ever mentioning that this was a Masonic passage. And that tells me everything I need to know, because we've got centuries and centuries of Jewish writing on this, and there's nothing to back up the Christian claim at all, which makes me very suspicious that we're dealing with a shoehorning of a belief in rather than exegesis out of a passage. And yeah, in the same way that you complain that Muslims read Isaiah 42 to see Muhammad, Jews complain that Christians are reading their passages about Jesus. And in both complaints, actually, yeah, I see the logic of the argument of the complaint, to be honest.
Yeah. You might be right that no one before the time of Christianity understood Isaiah 53 to be kind of about the Messiah, you know, a suffering Messiah. I'm just going to say, I need to look into that more. I'm not sure. I mean, there have been certain proposed texts where that might be going on, maybe not.
Well, I've never come across it. And Christians, usually when they come back to me on this point, they always end up quoting the Midrash or something. You know what I mean? They don't seem to realize what they're quoting is not prior to the rise of Christ, because they don't really understand the material they're quoting. But if they look at it properly, it's not dated prior to the rise of Christianity at all. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but I've never come across a passage in any Jewish literature prior to the rise of Christianity that ever spoke as Christians do about these passages. So when Christians accuse Jews of not seeing what's there, I'm sorry, it was never there in the first place, according to Jews.
So let me try and share some information from the New American Commentary, which is a very conservative series, but they interact with a lot of mainstream scholarship as well. At the end of their passage on Isaiah 53, they've got an excursus called The Early Interpreters of the Suffering Servant. Yep. And it's interesting there. So there's a few things there. So first of all, in terms of the translation, so Martin Hengel writes, although the motif of vicarious atoning suffering, which affects salvation, is weakened at a few points in the Septuagint over against the MT, it remains unambiguous. So that theme is still to some extent retained in the Septuagint, even though it's toned down. And then at Qumran, so two Aramaic documents from Qumran, this is 4Q540 and 4Q541, dated to also called 4Q Apocryphon of Levi, dated to around 100 BC. So this is before. So 4Q541 talks about someone who, quote, will atone for all the children of his generation, end quote. But the people of that time, quote, will utter many words against him, will utter every kind of disparagement against him. His generation will be evil, unquote.
There is some of this in Maccabees, the whole Maccabean revolt. So that's almost certainly talking about the Maccabean revolt, which obviously was in the geographical location. But I'm talking about Isaiah 53 here. And the Maccabean revolt has nothing to do with Isaiah 53.
Well, so I don't know if this is talking about Maccabees. Actually, the Dead Sea Scrolls, I thought, I'm on hazy ground here, I thought they had some actual disagreements with the Maccabees and kind of the priestly lineage from them. They massively disagreed over the temple system. I thought, and
the revolt here, yeah, I agree with you about the temple system. Yeah. The revolt itself, obviously, was the Maccabean groups that do exist.
Yeah, I don't know if the Dead Sea Scroll community like the Maccabean martyrs. Maybe they do, I don't know. But I need to double check that.
My point is that the obvious historical candidate for that kind of language is actually that in BC language, is that kind of language is found in the Maccabean corpus. You've not said this refers to Isaiah 53. So we're still waiting for any sense prior to the rise of Christianity that the Messiah was spoken of in Isaiah 53. That was the
point. So this is a tricky passage, and I'm not going to pretend it's otherwise, right? So it's been translated differently. You would have to look at it in the context and see exactly what it's referring to. I'm just saying this is a candidate where it talks about some kind of individual who is oppressed by others and who atones for others.
Have you read Maccabees? Have you read one Maccabees?
I've read Maccabees. As I say, I'm not sure that this is talking about Maccabees. Because from what I vaguely remember, I'm not sure that, again, don't quote me on this, check this out. I'm not sure the Dead Sea Scroll community like the Maccabees.
Sorry, you've not established any connection with Isaiah 53. Sorry, you're talking here as if you're assuming your conclusion in what you're saying. Is this in a commentary on Isaiah 53, for example? That's my question.
No, I don't think it's in a commentary there.
That is the question. You have to be specific here. You can't. The point is that before the rise of Christianity, Isaiah 53 was never understood in a messianic way. That's the claim I'm making. I could be wrong, but quoting a text like that without any clear reference is not an argument. It's just a floating text. And it could easily, in my view, be referring to other historical events.
Maybe. But what I'm trying to say is your statement that before Christianity, no one thought Isaiah 53 was about the Messiah. Yeah. I'm saying maybe. I'm saying there are passages before Christianity where there is some concept of righteous people suffering for others.
Of course,
that may be based on Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53 is a very plausible place to get that theology.
Of course, all that's Isaiah 53. I agree with you. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that it's a messianic. Passage.
Okay,
as a messianic passage, it's not.
Yeah. So the thing about the Dead Sea Scroll community is, and again, there's complexity. Did they believe in two messiahs, and how does the teacher of righteousness fit into that? I need to look into this more, right? I need to see, can this text be talking about the Messiah? Is it talking about the teacher of righteousness? How does the teacher of righteousness relate to the Messiah?
Does it mention the Messiah and what you quoted?
I don't think it uses the term Mashiach, but as we've discussed, there are agreed messianic places in the Old Testament that don't use that term.
You can't just assume the text doesn't mention it. I mean, it's like me saying Muhammad's mentioned all over the Old Testament. It doesn't mention him by name. Look at Song of Songs, but he means him. Now, you would dismiss that automatically.
But because the context doesn't allow. I've never said I need Muhammad's name in the Old Testament. I'm saying
my Muslim presuppositions, it's clearly there.
Okay. I believe I'm being consistent. I'm not saying a passage needs to say, and this is his name, and the name matches up. I am saying that, if you can show me, not Muhammad's name, you don't need that in Song of Solomon's, but if you can show me where Muhammad as the 7th century prophet fits, the theology of the Old Testament, he fulfills a role predicted in the Old Testament, then I'll be interested, then I'll be open. I've never said you need a name. Okay. I think that's a very high bar.
But that's fine. But anyway, I'm still waiting. I mean, maybe there is evidence for passage pre-Christianity that mentions Isaiah 53, and it has to mention it. You can't just be, I hope it means that. And I'm not aware there's any evidence.
Okay, maybe we should pick this up another time. What I'm saying is there's a whole excursus here that quotes from, Septuagint, different texts from Qumran, Testament of Benjamin, Wisdom of Solomon.
What do these texts say? There's a whole thing, but do any of these texts, does the Septuagint say that this is the Messiah in Isaiah 53?
Okay, I need to look at this more to see exactly what they say. All I'm saying is at this point, for you and for our viewers, the statement that before Christianity, no one understood Isaiah 53 to be messianic. I was going, I'm not sure. There are some texts which seem to pick up on this, which could be messianic. I'm not sure. Let me get back to you.
Seem and could are we need to be the same for the bus.
Of course, and I'm not trying to convince anyone now. I'm just trying to say.
I know you can look into this, but we need something that's more robust than simply it's possible that it means, because that it's possible it means lots of things. I'm saying, did any text prior to the rise of Christianity say that Isaiah 53 is messianic? Okay. That's what I want. I don't want vague possibilities. I want actual evidence.
But let's say I find a text which is 50-50, right? We agree, it sounds like it might be the Messiah, but it's not like certain, right? In that case, the appropriate statement, I think, would be, and I'd have to double check your exact language. So let me just say, if there are texts which sound like they could be talking about Isaiah 53 in terms of the Messiah, but it's not clear. Let me finish. That case, I think the appropriate thing would be to say, we do not know, we are not aware of pre-Christian understandings of Isaiah 53 as being about the Messiah,
I said several times, I've been very careful in my choice of words here, by the way, that remember I used the word extant, we have no evidence to say that, but it's possible, obviously in the past, we don't know that someone did, but according to the evidence we have, it's my view, I could be wrong, that there is no evidence that Isaiah 53 was cited as a messianic text, it's not enough to me to say, well, it might do, could have been, because given the presuppositions that are at work here, very powerful presuppositions, you know, people are going to see Jesus all over the place.
Okay.
We need something more robust and clear than, well, it's possible, because, well, it's possible is not good enough. Because
I think possibilities lead to possibilities.
Is a subtext of this, oh, it could be about Jesus after all. That's what you're really saying.
No.
Yes, it is.
No. I am being reasonable. If I look, maybe Jesus isn't the suffering servant. That doesn't mean that there is no concept of a suffering servant. Purely as a historian, are texts.
But there are sufferings. Don't get me wrong. Of course, Isaiah is about a suffering servant.
And I'm saying, from a historical perspective, is it possible that these texts, because we know that there were strong Jewish messianic beliefs shortly before the time of Jesus. So the question is, well, did some of these passages ever equate the two, right? If there are texts which look like they could be, could not be, then I think the appropriate statement is maybe, but we don't know, rather than there are none.
No, you see, these maybes and could-bes are basically a Trojan's horse to allow the possibility of a Christianized reading. And I think I just want to see evidence where Isaiah 53 is clearly stated to be messianic. And I don't think you're going to find that, because if it existed, we would have come across it by now. This would have been used in polemics in apologetics Christians for years. I've never come across anywhere. What they do, as I repeatedly say, they take stuff they think is pre-Christian when it's actually not. That's what nearly always happens. They'll quote from the Talmud. Oh, look, it's in an ancient text. Yes, the Talmud was written in the 4th and 5th centuries AD. Centuries are, you know, but people don't understand the datings of these things, and so they think they're refuting it, and they're not. Now, you're not making that mistake, but I'm talking before the rise of Christianity. No Jew that we know of ever thought these passages were messianic in the way Christians do at all. I just don't see any evidence. If there had been evidence, it would be mentioned by now. I mean, it would have been mentioned in these commentaries. You can be sure a Catholic commentary would mention it, wouldn't it?
I just feel like your statement is, either we have clear evidence of it or it doesn't exist. Whereas I'm saying there's a middle position, which is there is ambiguous evidence and we don't really know which way it
ambiguous goes. Ambiguous evidence is a way of smuggling in through the back door.
No, I think, to be intellectually honest, there are many times where we have to say we don't actually know which way this is pointing. I thought I was taught that as standard academic, you know, procedure, which is, if something's not clear, don't overstress it. Say we don't really know which way it goes.
Well, but bring the evidence. I mean, we're talking in theory now, we're not talking about anything concrete. Bring the evidence of a passage from a Jewish source prior to the rise of Christianity that you think is speaking about a Messiah, Isaiah 53. Then we'll weigh up the ambiguities or not. I would prefer something that was clear.
Likewise,
cool. But I think you're not going to find it, and I think if you're having to rely on ambiguities and maybes and possibilities to shore up a weak case, then I think people are not going to find that very compelling. They're not going to find it compelling.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the time I'm not necessarily trying to compel people to my belief in Jesus as the Messiah. I also just believe in, as I'm sure you know you do, accurate, truthful statements. And even if it doesn't bring us any closer to, you know, accepting Jesus, I just want to make the most accurate statements about ancient Jewish beliefs.
Of course. I mean, I'm very happy. So I'm talking to Rabbi Tovi Singer this coming week in several days. He's in Jerusalem. Now, he of course is a passionate anti-missionary.
Yes.
Who's trying to, you know, keep Jews Jewish and not let them be gobbled up by the missionaries. And I will run some of these passages by him to get his views, but he will absolutely, I'll ask him, is there any Jewish text prior to the rise of Christianity that talks about Isaiah 53? And he will know, because this guy knows them all in Hebrew. I mean, he's brilliant. So I'll ask him what he says. I mean, I know what he's going to say. He's going to say they don't exist, because otherwise...
Yeah.
And that tells us a lot.
Well, you say otherwise, but again, an Orthodox Jew who rejects Christianity can very freely accept, if it were true, that there, you know, there were messianic understandings of Isaiah 53. He just doesn't think Jesus is that. So I don't think our presuppositions have to answer this question. As a Christian, it could be that Christianity is unique and no one has read these passages in this way. As I said before, my Christian understanding of Isaiah 49 and 52 to 53 is that the Jewish people would not understand this. They would miss who this suffering figure was. So I really don't think our worldviews have to determine the answer we come to on this empirical question.
No, they don't, but they tend to nonetheless. People underestimate the power of their unconscious philosophical bias when they interpret, even though with in conscious integrity they may determine not to, but they are nevertheless still, given the structure, the intellectual structure of their mind, they still cannot but read it that way. When I read the Quran, I try not to, I can't, it's strange really, I cannot but read it as the word of God. I know it sounds a weird thing to say, but I can't read it as the word of Muhammad. It just seems totally alien to me. And I'm pretty sure for you, you cannot read it as the word of God, but you read it as the word of Muhammad. And it doesn't matter how much I try to take off glasses, I can't read it. That's how it is to me. Phenomenologically, yeah. That's just how I experience it. And it's like some people, you know, when they listen to, give another silly example, you know, they hear Bach, they go into raptures like I do. Other people hear Bach and they think, oh God, what's this silly old music? You know, what can I say? People are different and they hear and see things differently. And I can't, no matter how much I may strain and try and not see something in the way that I do, I can't stop doing it. I can't stop enjoying Bach, and I can't read the Quran differently. It's just, it interacts with my mind as word of God. Yeah.
I just want to say, I don't believe the Quran is divinely revealed. I think that's quite obvious. Yeah. But in terms of, I can't but read it as, you know, the words of the historical conclusion I have to draw is that Muhammad is involved in it. But broadly speaking, and there might be certain exceptions, I don't think it is the voice. It doesn't, you know, because even if it is Muhammad, he is speaking as the prophetic, you know, divine voice. So I don't think it has the voice of Muhammad, because that's not what it professes to be. Also, you have this intriguing, there's a book called The Self-Referentiality in the Quran.
Yeah, it's truly a phenomenon in the Quran. Yeah, no, I agree. It's just amazing.
And, you know, it's the kind of persona of the Quran is very clearly a divine persona, whether or not one, the question is it authentic? But it's very much a divine figure of speech. Yeah. Maybe that went without saying, but I didn't want the audience to think that I'm, you know, just sitting there saying every verse kind of smells or sounds like Muhammad. You know, I don't think that's true.
No, what I meant is phenomenologically. And what I meant by that was in terms of your experience of reading the text, you don't read it as God addressing you when you read the Quran, do you?
Right. No. So in that sense,
that's, but as a literary thing, you of course recognize that the author is God in terms of its presentation, its self-referential, as you said, presentation. Of course you recognize that, but as I said, I was talking phenomenologically, not in terms of its literary self-presentation. I encounter it phenomenologically as word of God. You acknowledge it claims that, but you don't experience it as that, and that was my point. I can't stop I've tried to, because I thought, this is really weird. Why is this book always engaging me as divine? Because it's not obvious that it should. And bits of the Bible have done that to me and still do, actually. It's not.
I remember you saying in a recent video,
They do still, because I think a lot of the Bible is very much the word of God, but it's mixed up with a lot of human stuff as well, unfortunately. So, all right. Well, I don't think we should tackle Isaac for the reasons we mentioned, because it wouldn't really get us anywhere, because we'd be running on parallel lines and we're not going to connect. You have your good reasons as a Christian to read it the way you do. From a Christian, that makes a lot of sense. I'm reading it from a different perspective. That makes sense. And they are different paradigms, different worldviews. And they're not going to, we can't merge them or pretend that they can be collapsed into one worldview. Yeah. Because they are different.
As we bring this, and I don't mean to be pickety, but as we bring this video to a close, I think it's worth me expressing that and reminding our viewers that we are having a different assessment of the state of affairs. I am claiming that, taking off my Christian glasses, I still think the best understanding of what the, you know, 8th century author or you know, 6th or 5th century author of Deutero-Isaiah, the best historical factual understanding of what they're saying is still about Jesus. You beg to differ, and you think that actually I've still got my Christian glasses on, which is fine. But if you're summing up the video, I just don't want people to think that I'm agreeing with your assessment, because we are fundamentally disagreeing on how I am approaching this text.
There's any danger of people thinking that you agree. No, I think it's quite clear that you have a different take. And I think our positions are, which is fine, and our positions are ultimately irreconcilable because our first principles are different. And that's the nature of life itself.
I'm disagreeing on that as well.
Really?
Yes, because you think my first principle, you think the way you have often portrayed me, and I don't mean this in a malicious way at all, but the way you've often portrayed me this evening is that I'm starting with Jesus and reading that back in. Mm. I'm trying to say to you, my first principles, to the best of my ability, have been, let's just start with the text, the Old Testament text, and go where it takes us. So I am claiming that we are not differing in our first principles. You are claiming that we are differing in our first principles.
Yes, because I think the power of our worldviews is much stronger and much more of an influence than you give it credit. And often we can't just, as an act of will, say, oh, I'm taking off my glasses and now I'm seeing things neutrally. I think in the real world, people don't, that's not how people behave.
Fair enough.
I think in terms of understanding of our psychology and the way we live our lives, your sincerity is absolutely genuine. I don't get me wrong. I think you are exactly what you say. You believe exactly what you say you're doing is the case. You're absolutely sincere. But nevertheless, my view is that your views are much more formative of your intellectual furniture than you're aware of, shall we say. That's what I'm saying. And we disagree on that as well.
Indeed, indeed. Very good. Well, Paul, thank you so much for having me on. It's been a very interesting discussion. And I hope it's interesting and of some use to people.
Absolutely. And what was I going to say? I may have to chop this video. I'm getting advice from people saying, a guy said to me yesterday, I like the videos, Paul, because they're short, 10 minutes.
Okay. Okay. This is not short.
This is not, how's this going to play? Do I chop it up into segments so people can digest them because that's what we're like in the modern age? Or do I just throw it out anyway and let the three people who have soldiered on to the end here be those three people? I don't know. What do you think?
I think both of those formats have their followers. I think chopping it up is definitely good. Some people respond to that. But it has been commented that in kind of the age of, Jordan Peterson and people like that, and who's the big one? Joe Rogan. The immense popularity of Joe Rogan. There are people out there who do love just free-flowing conversations for 2 or 3 hours. So I would say if you have the time, do the shorter videos, but also upload the whole thing. I think different people like both.
No, I think you're right. Maybe I'm just hearing from people are those who have short memory spans. But it's funny, these people will go to the cinema, and watch a film they like. Do they walk out after 10 minutes because that's their attention? Of course they don't. They stay for 2 or 3 bloody hours. So,
I wish we were as exciting as the latest.
No, this idea, I couldn't possibly sit through anything more than 10 minutes. Well, so when you go to the cinema, you walk out after 10 minutes, do you?
Yeah. No.
So, what gives there? So,
You'll have to edit in some explosions and car chases and all sorts. You need to get a lava lamp, Paul. If you had a lava lamp, you'd sit there for hours.
I'm going to put little horns on your head. I'm going to put some flames coming up from under this. No, I'm only joking. And I've got The Simpsons, isn't there, where someone in a new cast was the Republican was a guy in the backdrop, horns, and the Democrat was the smile. And it was Fox News, a mistake of Fox News. Okay, well, thanks for that, and I think we both deserve a cup of tea and by the way, on change of subject, I think if I'm not mistaken, next Sunday Speaker's Corner is open again, although I'm not confirmed. Well, because the rules change tomorrow, don't they, about the 6 congregations or something. So I'm not saying you'll be jumping down there, but I think I might pop down just for the sheer freedom of being able to do it. You know what I mean?
Well, I'll do the same. It's very tempting. Oh, of course, it is Easter.
Oh,
afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe. No, just the idea of actually going out into public space and talking to people and not having to.
There you go. Could be more appropriate on Easter?
Exactly. We're coming out of our tombs, indeed. All right. Well, thank you so much, Richard Zetter, for your amazing.
Thank you so much.
And everything on patience and stuff, and we'll be in touch again. Till next time.
Super. Thanks, Paul. Have a good one.
Yeah, bye-bye.